Week of July. I'm your host, Steven Sarek Shook, and as always with me are Austin Broodwars Parkin.
Yes, the rumors are true, people. I do actually play games on Nintendo platform.
Donald Shaman Terrial.
So what's the foreign guy supposed to say? Oh yeah, ahoy hoy, eh?
Ryan Raxt Clay.
Oh yeah, it's the podcast, people.
Agents are go!
So today, we're coming to you and stepping it up to fill in a gap that our friends over at RFN have filled in the voids of our heart by going on such things as vacation. I mean, what did they think this was? Some sort of democracy or something? I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I guess Johnny's still trying to chase down the police report for his 3DS. Been there, done that.
I don't know why they think that they can take a week off.
At least he has an excuse.
Well, anyway. So this week, Nintendo Free Radio is stepping it up, and we're going to be bringing you your regular dose of radio-free Nintendo formatting with our delightful twist on it. Started off, we've got games to talk out, and we're going to start out new biz. I'm going to start that off with Mass Effect 3. Just finished it, got to the ending, did the extended content and all the DLC. I actually played through the games 1 through 3. Within the last 3 months, so I played them relatively close together.
So at least you have memories of what your character was doing for the first couple of games, and I think that's probably how I'll end up doing it when I finally start playing Mass Effect 3.
Yeah, I would recommend it, because if you can remember everything, you can start tying together that, oh, wait a minute, I did help this person in looting bin when you get that message.
Oh, and I did help the woman out, by, the woman with post-traumatic stress disorder by, you know, taking care of her, if you will.
Yeah, how about, I know you've played the games, Austin. About what time frame did you play them in?
Well, I started playing Mass Effect 2, I'd say about 2 years ago, I'd say. I got in the summer then when I got my 360, and I played through all that. I actually picked it up again on PS3, and that didn't work out too well. I also waited to pick up Mass Effect 3 until this extended cut DLC was announced, just because, you know, not only that, I wanted to get the real picture of their ending that they had in mind, since they were so adamant that they had a vision for it, but also, by the time that I had the money to buy it, I was sick of hearing about Mass Effect 3, because every podcast was devoted to talking about it for like 3 hours a week.
That's true. So did you play the first one?
Yes, I did.
Overall, I hate to give it to it, but 2 is probably the overall best one, but I really think 3 was the one that really solidified the actual what they wanted to do with the weapons. Because 1, you saw it all there, but it was just way overwhelming. 2, you didn't have the upgrades. You couldn't tweak it to customize it for yourself as much. I literally played the whole game with the same sniper rifle, and it was fine. 3, at the very least, I got to switch my auxiliary weapons and everything, and I could tweak them. I could put heat sinks on them, the stabilizers. I thought it was a good mix. I do miss that they took out the hacking, though.
Yeah, I do agree with you. I think that Mass Effect 2 is the best of the series. I do think they finally figured out what they wanted to do with some elements of Mass Effect 3. Like, in Mass Effect 1, you had the grenades, but no one used them because they were kind of useless and hard to trigger. So they took them out for Mass Effect 2, then they brought them back in for Mass Effect 3 as an ability that you would just restock grenades on, and that worked actually really well.
I honestly didn't use grenades really at all in Mass Effect 3. In 1, I did some, but in 3, I got them, and it was like, okay. So my character is literally maxed out on everything and not grenades.
Yeah, let's establish for a moment, what class is your character?
I was the sniper, which is Infiltrator.
Oh, okay, and I was the Sentinel. So my class was based around using abilities and spells. I like to play mage-type characters whenever I play RPGs. And that class, one of his abilities is, I think it's called the Biotic Grenade. Or it's a Lift Grenade. You toss a grenade into a bunch of guys, and it flings them up in the air. It actually does a pretty decent amount of damage.
Yeah, I played it. Well, while we're on there, Mass Effect 3, I have to give it credit for the multiplayer. I actually quite like the multiplayer. You level up characters up to level 20 and lets you try all the different classes, and it's pretty much you against the enemy, but then they spice it up by having objectives thrown in every once in a while. I think it really works for what they were trying to do.
Well, I never got a chance to play the multiplayer, partly because I'm not an Xbox Live Gold member. I never will be an Xbox Live Gold member. And so I couldn't have played it if I wanted to. I mean, I got a code for 2 days of gold, but I wanted to see if I could beat the game on single player and get the ending that I wanted. Well, I didn't get that, but I managed to get what the game considers to be the best ending just playing single player. And that's because in the Extended Cut DLC, they actually lowered the requirements for the best ending from, I think it's like 3,800 galactic readiness down to like 3,100. So I easily managed to clear that.
You couldn't clear 38? I was literally, on my game, I got it halfway through the game.
Doesn't it start bleeding off, though, if you don't play the game for even like 24 hours?
It doesn't bleed off. Think about a baseball team, okay? You've got all your players. You'll always have all your players. What readiness is whether half your players are asleep or all of them are awake. The quantitative number is the effectiveness of how effective you are.
So if you're at max readiness and your team's healthy, if you're at the lowered requirement, you're basically the Toronto Blue Jays right now with 9 pitchers and their 2 best hitters on the injured list.
Yeah. I think my final galactic readiness, not taking into account the multiplayer, was something like 7,800, but because the default, if you don't play multiplayer, is 50%, that was only brought down to like 3,500, somewhere in that area.
Yeah, I think 3,900 if you're getting cut in half. That's a pretty nasty penalty, but hey, Xbox Live, it's like global thermonuclear war. Only winning move is not to play.
You guys should have played on the PC. The PC is the way to play that game. I'm sorry, but I cannot see how it really lends itself to dual analog controls. Well, but I did play a sniper, so precision aiming was a lot of what I did. I mean, being able to pop headshot, pop headshot, pop headshot.
Yeah, my class was designed to hang around behind cover and fling spells at people. So I really wasn't shooting all that much, at least in Mass Effect 3. In Mass Effect 2, most of my gameplay was just freezing guys and then blasting them into shards.
Is there any distinct gameplay change from 3 over 2 that you prefer?
From 3 over 2?
Yeah. Something they added in 3?
Well, the weapon stuff. The weapon stuff, definitely. Now you can make your weapon hold more ammo. You can make it steadier. You can, on the sniper rifle, you can get a module that will up your sniper readiness time. So when you go into sniper zoom mode, it slows everything down to sort of like bullet time for only a certain amount of time. The infiltrator gets a little bit of that naturally. But you can also put a module in there that gives you more, so it makes it really easy to zoom in, and when the guy's trying to run, slow him down, pick him off, move on to the next one. They had most everybody you were going to combat were on the field when you started. They didn't just come into the field. So if you watch carefully, you could plan out what you were doing and get people from a distance. In 2, it wasn't so much of that. And then 3, they are notorious about things coming in. So you'll go into this, quote, empty area, and then suddenly enemies will come in. So now they're already in close range to you.
Yeah, that's kind of my main problem with 3 is, 3 is based a lot on wave attacks, with you bunkering down and just waves upon Reaper goons just rushing at you. And that got really tiresome for me after a while. I mean, Mass Effect 2 was roundly criticized for having corridor levels, but yeah, I thought that the levels in Mass Effect 2 were more interesting. Whereas in 3, you're always facing either Cerberus or Reaper troops.
Yeah, you get one little area with Geth, and that's it. Mass Effect 2 had a lot more variety. Mass Effect 1, not so much, but I think it had more story than all of them. Even though you saw a lot of it trickle in 2, and then 3, you could tell they were trying to wrap it up to a predetermined end, and they didn't know how to still do that while still having a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, I'll agree with you that the mod system was very nice, and I really appreciate that they tried to stay away from doing what they did in Mass Effect 1, which was that they just dumped these mods on you, and you had a massive inventory that was ridiculous to try and manage. So in Mass Effect 3, when you get a mod, if you get a version that's better than the mod that you already have, it just replaces it.
Well, actually, Mass Effect 3 you always get a better version than the one you have. You'll see this in the multiplayer more if you play the multiplayer, but if you get a upgrade for, let's say, the heatsink, you get an upgraded heatsink. If you find another heatsink, it upgrades your heatsink to level 2. Find another one, it upgrades it to level 3. And it becomes more apparent that's what's actually happening in the multiplayer, because in the multiplayer, you buy packs of weapons, and you can either spend real money or credit you earn. You earn credit so quick, I don't know why anybody would spend real money. But when you buy those, you'll get a gun. If you get the gun again, you get the level 2 version of it. It just upgrades your gun.
Now, out of curiosity, did they do anything with your character's class that was different in Mass Effect 3 than it was in 2? Because a big problem I have with 3 is that my character, the Sentinel, his special ability in Mass Effect 2 was to create a shield. It was basically an extra layer of shield that would make you a lot harder to take out. And when they did take your shield out, it would detonate a pulse that would knock down all enemies around you. In Mass Effect 3, your shield is the same as it is whether you have that shield up or not. All it really does is decrease your cooldowns for when you use your spells. So it's kind of useless now for the most part. You never take it off.
They did change it because I remember having to do some adjustments, but I probably liked it out. The stealth changed a little bit, and I was able to do more melee stuff. I became more of a melee class because you have two ranges as an infiltrator. You're either far away or you're melee killing somebody. That's it. There's no mid game.
Yeah.
I mean, you can use an assault rifle midway, but you're pretty squishy. But I have to say, in that game, invisibility in all of them is almost uber, because you could be in the middle of a fight, pop it, and then suddenly they're looking somewhere else, even if they were just shooting at you.
Yeah, I do have to say, though, that considering the number of enemies in the game that have armor or shields, the Sentinel class is actually pretty useful, because you always have something that can deal damage against special defenses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did think also in 3 that the unit design wasn't very varied. Everybody had about 5 units, and then they just recycled them over and over again. And the ending, I mean, not the ending story-wise, but the ending, the last bit of action you do, there's really was sort of a letdown, to tell you the truth. There's not really an end boss.
Yeah, the Mass Effect 2 was really criticized for the Terminator at the end of the game. Something I never really had a problem with it. It was kind of silly, but it opens up a big plot hole in Mass Effect 3 where they establish that, oh, the Reapers, when they're formed, they take the form of whatever creature was used to create them. You know, they're representative of that race. Okay, well then why then is 99% of the Reaper fleet giant flying squids?
End guy tells you that. I mean, the end guy does tell you why that is, which I'm not going to go into.
We don't want to go into that, but I just find that funny. But, you know, you were talking about all the enemies being largely the same. How about all the NPCs? I don't think I've seen that many cloned NPC creatures and NPC civilians in a long time.
I haven't seen that many clones since I watched Star Wars, and now I wouldn't. But, yeah, there are a lot of clones. There is a lot of cloned people. You're either unique, generic, or in the case of the Quarian, they don't really know what they want to do with you. So
yeah, BioWare had no idea what they were going to do with the Quarians without the helmets. So instead they chose to Photoshop.
They pun it. There is a whole level. Minor spoiler alert. There's a level where you get to interact with the Geth.
That was a cool level.
And there's a part where you're looking at some lore and everything, and they're doing a visual representation, and the Quarians are still in their suits, even though at that point in time, they hadn't even developed their suits.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
So they're severely lacking quads at BioWare, in other words.
Well, BioWare lacked an end game for Quarians. When they started at the beginning, they said, hey, this would be cool to have a migrant fleet, and they worked on that part, and that's cool. They had the Geth, but they had no end game with the suit.
Well, but clearly they didn't know what they wanted to do with Tali, because she was obviously a character that players wanted to romance in the first game, and apparently they complained enough that she was brought back in the second game for that.
I wanted to romance her with my Shepard, for goodness sake, and instead I got Caden. He's whiny.
I had a male Shepard, so I could do that.
I did eventually nail a woman, so.
Did it take you 3 games?
No, it took me that, but that's because I wasn't really gunning for it. See, my Shepard In the first game, I actually took all the charm talents and all the intimidate talents. So my Shepard has a bar that you've got Paragon and Renegade. If you've played any BioWare game, that should be familiar. It's dark and light side for all intents and purposes, which is actually what they do in SOTOR. She has max Paragon, but she also has a good amount of Renegade points. So I pretty much have my choice of intimidating or helping people throughout the game. And the offshoot of that is everyone likes me or are somewhat scared of me.
Yeah, actually, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I thought that was a change that they made that was really good. Because the complaint that they got a lot in the first two games was that there was really no reason to play as a more gray type character. It was kind of, it's kind of the infamous problem too, where if you wanted to be able to do the most charm or the most intimidate, you had to play one or the other at all times, and that was really constricting. But in
that's true.
Yeah, but in Mass Effect 3, you can play however you want, and it just adds up to an overall bar.
Yeah, I mean, the first one, I had, as I said, I tried to max out Intimidate and Charm, and there were still Intimidate options in the end that I couldn't open.
Yeah, let me guess, it was against that final guy in the ending? Because I couldn't...
No, it was even before that, because my Intimidate just wouldn't go up as fast as my Charm would. Just wouldn't do it.
Okay, because I had my Charm maxed out, and I could not persuade that last moment where you have that option. Just to... move things on. If I remember correctly, you had a problem with this game because you had trouble finding, what was it, that last piece of DLC for Mass Effect 2, The Arrival.
Oh, yeah. So Mass Effect 1, Mass Effect 2, and Mass Effect 3, one of the offshoots of playing them later was that the DLC was out and I could get it. Well, I had gotten the collector's edition of Mass Effect 2 for really cheap, and it was supposed to have all the DLC. That was wrong. So I started Mass Effect 3, and all of a sudden it's like, what the heck? What happened? I literally just stopped this game and started this game. There's a big gap here. Well, that was another DLC, The Arrival, and you had to get it directly from BioWare, which was a pain in the butt to find. It's on like social.bioware.com, I believe is the site. It is really hard to find that DLC, and it was just bad. You couldn't even just buy it off of Origin.
Yeah, and The Arrival is referenced a lot in Mass Effect 3. A lot of characters, especially Batarians, make reference to that.
Yeah.
I think the only one that they might reference more than that is Project Overlord.
So they basically Kingdom Hearts'd it, like with the content that's only in Japan that's apparently canon?
Pretty much, but you could pay for it.
Yeah.
I mean, if you played the game on consoles, you knew they told you that it was coming, and they told you that Mass Effect 3 would tie into it, and you can easily find it from the shop. It sounds like they actually had that piece of DLC for the PC version in a completely different store.
Yeah, well, I think what happened was that Mass Effect 1 and 2 is on Steam, but Mass Effect 3 isn't on Steam and everything. And what happened was between when the DLC came out, the last bit of DLC came out, there was a falling out with Steam.
Yeah, I remember that. It got pulled from Steam. It was a major controversy for a little bit.
It was one of those type of deals, but I do want to wrap this up soon, but I do want to talk about one more thing on this. James, what is up with that? I start this game, Mass Effect 3, and then there's James here, and James talking to you like your old war buddies. And then immediately when you're on the ship, it's like he never knew you.
Yeah, it's weird. As soon as I got a character to replace him, he was sitting on the ship the rest of the game.
That's what I did too. But I was really thinking that, okay, well, he's talking to Shepard like he really knows her and everything like that. So he must be somebody from before she became a Spectre, because Shepard was an N7 officer before that. She was noted. She was decorated before Mass Effect even began.
Yeah, but
began.
Then he starts asking
so
her about
it. Would make sense. Yeah, and then she started asking her about that, and you start asking her about that. I really think that was a really big missed opportunity with BioWare to really flesh out the Shepard character there.
Yeah, plus Vega makes reference to the fact that he was fighting against the Collectors in Mass Effect 2. Would have been nice to have met him at some point during Mass Effect 2.
Well, he was fighting somewhere else. I mean, they made that pretty clear.
Out of curiosity, have you read any of the Mass Effect books?
No.
Yeah, I've read the first three, I believe. I think there are four, and the fourth one is the one that no one wants to admit exists because it has massive continuity errors. Something I really appreciated in this game, as well as the two before, is that they like to make reference to the books. What did you think of Kai Lang?
I hear he's a badass in the books. I was very glad to kill him simply because he killed one of my favorite characters. A lot of the characters in this game, I found that the main characters, they could have all died in a fire, and I probably wouldn't have cared. There are a lot of side characters, though, that are totally different. And the one that he ends up picking off is one of the ones that I actually was quite attached to. I also found that my hardest decisions I made were not the big global ones. They were pretty much, oh, wait, well, this is what I'm going to choose. It was the ones around the Citadel, actually, where the people were arguing things like that. And I could see both sides, and I was thinking about the big ramifications of them, because they did have big ramifications.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. It's one of my big sticking points with the game is that there are really two really big moments in the game that are supposed to have this major impact, and I thought they felt kind of flat. You know, it's the conflict between the Krogan and the Turians, and between the Geth and the Quarians. And even though I thought they ended acceptably, they were just missing that extra little punch, but the death of that character that you reference is probably my favorite scene in the game.
The Quarian and Geth one really wasn't that bad. I mean, out of the big scenes, I think that was probably one of the better done ones.
Did you resolve that peacefully?
Oh, yeah. I mean, to put it in perspective, my Mass Effect 2 save saves the Geth, and the one that I did, I got the peaceful one where everybody ended up being together and loving each other and Age of Aquarius stuff. Yeah.
Out of curiosity, when it comes to Kai Ling, what did you think when you first saw him in-game? Because my first thought upon seeing him is, they're like, hey, it's that guy. And I look at him and go, Nightwing?
I didn't think that, but I didn't see that when you posted that.
Yeah, because he's decked out in a blue costume with a mask and a sword. He's practically Nightwing.
Yeah. All right, we probably should move on.
Oh, yeah.
Probably talked a little bit too much about Mass Effect 3, like every other podcast.
Oh, I suppose in a way, if we want to keep this tax deductible here, is there any way that they can get you guys to buy the Wii U version when it comes out this fall?
They would have to make it a complete edition. Honestly, if you told me right now that you were going to put Mass Effect 3's weapon system into Mass Effect 1 and tone down the Mako, because I actually don't mind the vehicle. I mind that it's just so much of it.
I love that they make fun of it in Mass Effect 3. They make fun of both of the last vehicles.
Well, did you play the vehicle in Mass Effect 2?
Yeah, the Hammerhead.
It is awesome.
Well, there's this hilarious scene, if you look for it, where they have Vega and your pilot arguing with each other over which vehicle sucked more, and it's hilarious.
Yeah, I remember that. But to get me to rebuy it on the Wii U, they would have to do a complete edition with all the DLC already in it. Because if you do play Mass Effect, you really need to play it with all the DLC. It's almost to the point of not being optional.
Yeah.
Yeah, Nostin, you played the PS3 version, so you know that apparently if they try to catch you up with a comic, it's going to be crippled.
Yeah, a lot of people seem to think that comic thing, a lot of people who didn't play the PS3 version are like, oh yeah, they can just do a comic thing for Mass Effect 3. All right, let me tell you for a moment how the comic works for Mass Effect 2. They do a voiceover, and they're like, hey, I met this Krogan. He told me about the Genophage who wiped out his people, you know, 20 seconds later. You know, this Krogan, he wanted to keep this Genophage cure. Did I kill him or did I save him? It is literally like that bad. There is no context for anything. You don't know any of the characters, and you're not getting anything close to the real experience.
To put that in perspective, that choice on my game when it came time, Mass Effect 1, to make that choice, I didn't even know it was a choice to kill him at that point in time. He was pretty much my group all the time. So it was like, well, of course I'm going to be taking him along and stuff like that and get him out of this funk because I need him.
Yeah, the only way that they could get me to buy Mass Effect 3 again, and honestly, I don't know if I'd ever want to play Mass Effect 3 again, that I have major problems with the endings, that they don't really give you a real choice. They would have to remake Mass Effect 1 and, you know, tweak to them and release them as a package, because there's really no reason to buy the Wii U version of Mass Effect 3.
And also probably add hacking back into Mass Effect 3, because I really did miss it. It feels sort of pointless walking up to safes and doors, or the doors where you have to hold your hand in front of them, doing nothing, where the hacky would have been.
Yeah, my last word on Mass Effect 3 is, for my problems with the big things, Bioware is still the master of the little things, the little conversations you walk in on, the little jokes, especially with Rex and Garrus.
I don't give them the master's thing. I've played enough BioWare games that there are times that they really can hit it, but it's really hit or miss. I mean, I played SOTOR, for goodness sake. And there are some things in there that are really great, but there are just as many, if not more, things that you're going, what were you thinking?
You know, as someone who's never played Mass Effect, because I've always been very hesitant of the series, I guess I could wait for like a Steam sale or something on the two games to play them, because I'm actually really interested in trying Mass Effect 3 on Wii U. That would be the very first time that I actually play the game, which is why I asked earlier about any gameplay advancements that they made from 2 over 3, because, I mean, doesn't 3 have a cover system, or 2 has a cover system like that?
2 introduces the cover system as really being used. I mean, 1 does have sort of a cover system.
Yeah, it just doesn't work very well, like a lot of things about Mass Effect 1.
Yeah. 2 is where the cover system really starts getting emphasized. But you lose your weapons, sort of become super generic in a way, because you can't modify them and tweak them. If you definitely do, that's what I did. I picked them up on a Steam sale. Definitely just watch for a Steam sale, because they are worth playing if you can get them for a good price. But if you do play them, if you're one of those people who don't like to replay things a lot, make sure you get the DLC as well. Mm-hmm. And if you get them on a Steam sale, you should be able to get all that for cheap. Unfortunately, you can't get the 2 that come from BioWare for Mass Effect 2, so you're going to have to bite the bullet and buy the 2 extra ones. And they are worth it. The Shadow Broker and it's the Shadow Broker and the Arrival, and they're both worth getting. Yeah, that's Mass Effect 3. Love it. Hate it. The Mass Effect series over now. Did you get the ending with the guys?
Could you be more specific?
Without spoiling
stars.
It?
It's the ending where you can't actually, you know they're people because they're outlines.
Oh yeah, the Stargazer thing at the end, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got that.
They make strong hints with that there are actually, they just pretty much go out and tell you that there's going to be other games in this universe.
Yeah.
Which might be fun. I mean, they could go back to the Contact Wars.
Yeah, I have to laugh at the fact that they removed the, there are more Adventures of Shepard coming. Wait for more DLC splash screen that apparently was there in the original version of the game.
Okay, well, moving on. I've been in the World of Warcraft beta because I'm one of those people who got the annual pass. It's like, well, I'm probably going to keep this for a year anyway. I might as well get Diablo 3 and beta into Mists of Pandaren.
Ryan, so this is the part where you start editing everything out, right?
Yes. This is the edit axe part. But anyway, the real reason I want to bring this up is that the last patch they've put in pet battles. And pet battles are pretty much been summed up as PokeWow. And I have to say, it really is PokeWow. But it is different. So there's types just like Pokemon. You're allowed to have a max of 3 moves on any pet. And it's really 6 moves because you can have 3 active moves you can use in battle, but there's 6 moves you can unlock for each pet. And each type has different moves, and each type has weaknesses and strength and everything like that.
So how many types are we looking at here? Because I know the Pokemon's had, you know, they've had 17 for a better part of a decade now.
It is not that many types, but there's human, undead, critter, beast, human, undead, critter, beast, mechanical, aquatic, planty one. I know there's a couple more I can't think of, but I was thinking about 10.
Yeah. Now, when you played this beta, did you play as one of the new Pandarians, or did you just import like your existing character?
I imported. I have a gnome warlock and a Draenei paladin. For one, I'm playing on a European server because the American one wasn't started. So even though I speak a little German and everything, and read a little German, I don't do well enough to actually talk to people. So that makes leveling something like a Pandaren interesting. I don't feel like leveling something all the way to max level in a beta that I know I'm going to lose it.
So one of the things I know that people have wanted in Pokemon for, you know, like a long time now is that like certain trainer types, like they want to have more character customization. So you maybe have a trainer that has an advantage if they're training a certain type. Does that sort of thing come into play in the pet battling?
No, but each type has their own advantages and everything. So let me take mechanical, because mechanical is the one I got off the top of my head. They have the innate, pretty much a racial that they in a battle once, if they get hit and they effectively would have died, they get 25% of their health back and they can keep going. And that's a mechanical ability. that's just passive for them. But yeah, they don't do the trainer type thing. But on the flip side, unlike Pokemon, since WoW, the pet battle system, there was pets already. So any pet you capture is really a WoW pet. So you can display them just like any WoW pet and have them follow you around and stuff like that. And when you go to capture one, and you know how in Pokemon there's Pokeballs. In this one, when you get them down, you literally throw a box on them. And the box expands out a little bit and closes on them. It's supposed to be a crate.
I think they had to do that to make sure that the lawyers didn't come down on them.
Yeah, but it's fairly amusing. And they also, so you start out with one, and they had level one's wilds tweaked way too high at the beginning because they could easily level your level one non-wild. And so you get your team, you catch them, then eventually you open up slots. The first few levels, you can only start out with one in your group. Then you can go to two, and then you can only swap them. Then you go to three, then you can only swap them. And eventually you'll be able to have two out at the same time and three out at the same time. And the reason I know that is that the wilds start doing that. So you're in your level one area, as soon as you get to a level five area, which is where you unlock being able to have two in your group and being able to switch them, when you run into a level five wild, there is a good chance that he also has a buddy and they will swap. And I went to a super high level zone for pet battle, at least. It was the last expansion zone, so it's not the highest level. And there, there was three pets out on the field at the same time. I don't know in current Pokemon how that...
Yeah, they have single, double. They have in the wild, you can meet them single or double. In trainer battles, you can do triple, which is three in play, and you issue commands for all three in the same turn. They also have the rotation battles, which is you have three out, but you move if you want, you can swap to one sort of in between. So that sounds similar to what you'd be doing.
Yeah.
They have a lot more of the rotation type battles in WoW.
Yeah, and in WoW you can go. They do have trainers, and everything set up. They have a quest line, so you go and you level up and you fight these NPC trainers like Pokemon does, and they also have a queue system where you can queue up and it will automatically pair you with another trainer, another human trainer, and you guys can fight.
Yeah.
And you can randomly just go up to people and duel them too. But you don't get XP for just randomly dueling people.
Yeah, that's how the Pokemon battles work online as well. Is there one monster that you've seen that's hideously overpowered like Garchomp is in Pokemon games?
Not yet, but it is early beta. They haven't gotten to the higher levels. Though I will say initially it's looking like there's ones that have attack that are sort of like a rush of them. So I went against this beetle, and the beetle, or actually I went against a wild rat, and the wild rat had an ability that was Stampede. All of a sudden, there's all these other rats, and they hit me three times for as much as a full attack.
Wow, so...
That one looks like it's possibly going to be overpowered.
Yeah, so they'll probably patch that. It's not enough for me, because I got out of competitive Pokemon battling about when Ruby and Sapphire came out, but I'm probably not going to get into Pokemon WoW until I know that it's somewhat balanced in that the hideously overpowered stuff's out of it. Basically, I'm not playing until they ban Garchomp.
Yeah. I mean, I think PokeWoW is going to be able to be balanced quicker than Pokemon is just by simply the nature of it.
Yeah, because you can patch PokeWoW very easily, but you cannot, you know, you have to basically issue a new game to patch out a Pokemon or issue a whole new generation. They only do that once every 4 years.
Yeah.
If you're lucky.
Yeah, and I honestly wouldn't. I wouldn't pick up at the current in its current state. I would not go into WoW solely for the pet battles and everything like that. But on the flip side, I do think that it is a very great addition for the next expansion because I know that'll give me a lot more to do. Now, once I get to max level, it's pretty much I raid and I only do that. I have no reason to log in on non-raid nights. With this, it gets me out in the world, it gets me capturing stuff, and it looks like it's going to be fun.
Yeah, and since you know, Pokemon Company said they're never doing an MMO, and I don't think Nintendo would ever have the online setup an MMO. I think if you want to get in, if you actually want to do it and have it be somewhat legitimate, you're probably going to have to go to WoW.
Yeah, but Pokemon is so perfect for an MMO. It's
they've they did an interview a few years ago with Phil Kohler when back he was writing freelance for What They Play, and they basically said they're still trying to encourage the face-to-face communication. That works really well in Japan, where you have, you know, where you can sell 2 million copies of a Pokemon game, of a Pokemon third version in a 9-day period. But
seriously,
yeah, it's gonna suck for us. But that's why, you know, there's sites out there devoted to, like, you know, battling and trading and all that.
Yeah, I mean, the only way that would work here in northern part of America and everything is if 90% of our landmass gets destroyed, but everyone happened to survive.
And it all compressed together, yeah, when you're two of the biggest.
Like, boom, suddenly our podcast, suddenly we start hearing overrun because everyone suddenly shrunk into the same room.
I honestly just don't understand. I mean, Nintendo is sitting on a gold mine if they would just do it. And I mean, as far as a Pokemon MMO goes, it would do very incredibly well. It aggravates me so much that they won't do it.
I get the feeling this is going to come up later as well. It's just like how they won't make a real console version of Pokemon. It's, if they were to do that, they couldn't recycle the same sprites or the same versions of sprites that they've been using for however many years now. They couldn't have the actual Pokemon voices still sound like microphone feedback off a speaker. They'd actually have to put in actual resources. And right now, people in Japan and worldwide, they buy them regardless of what they change.
I mean, yeah, it's sad when my personal favorite console version is Pokemon Stadium 1. It had the best music, had the best minigames. It did it right.
Yeah. I mean, at the very least, could we please finally implement the whole Pokemon say their own name thing from the animated series? Can we move on from the microphone feedback noises for them?
I think that's strictly nostalgia, because the original Pokemon have, you know, the cry. There's Pokemon that have identical cries, but it's only the old ones. The newer ones do have more clear, more distinct cries to them when they get called out, but yeah, the only reason, I'm pretty sure they would love to change Charizard's or Rhydon's cry, for instance, because they have the same one, but, you know, just if they did that, the fans would have a shit fit. Just like they did when they cut off.
That is true.
Well, because half of the fun of Pokemon is playing is the Nostalgia Fighter, but we should put a tack on that and come back to it later, because I've got some more on that.
Yeah, talking about nostalgia and everything, I've been playing Theater Rhythm.
Segway.
Yes, I do like segways. They do get you around quite well and everything with the little motor. Oh, wait a minute. We're not talking about the mechanical beast. Anyway, Theater Rhythm is the newest rhythm game by Square Enix. I'm trying to think if they've made another one.
Let me check, because I'm not sure if... Is Taiko no Tatsujin a Taito thing? Because if so, technically Square Enix would do that now.
Oh, maybe. But I think this is the first one that's totally been under the Square Enix.
Yeah, and actually, yeah, and Taiko no Tatsujin is Namco anyway, so forget that.
If you've listened to Connectivity, another one of the NWR podcasts, they had a really great segment about it last week, and I was going through that whole segment going, I haven't encountered that at all. Because I've been playing the whole thing stoic, which means no items. No items. All Fox. Final Destination. And so, which pretty much is how I've been playing Theater Rhythm. No abilities, no items, just the hero. And what that gives you is a 2 million point bonus, which aka gives you a fudge in the game. You can actually miss things and still get an S with the 2 million point bonus.
So basically you're playing it like it's Elite Beat Agents, even though there's extra things you could add on to enhance it if you want.
Or DDR or anything like that. I'm planning to go back and play through parts of it with the abilities because they sound cool. And for anybody who doesn't know what Theater Rhythm is, it's the rhythm game that's based off of Final Fantasy music. A lot of people put emphasis on the Final Fantasy music. If you like orchestrated music and a few 8-bit tunes, you'll like Theater Rhythm's music for the most part.
Well, you'll like a fourth of it. The rest are all chipping.
And again, if you don't like the music of Final Fantasy, you know, four, five, and six, I'm not sure if I'd like to know you.
No, I like it alright. It's just that I don't know I don't know whether to believe it was an artistic decision that they decided to just use the original format of those songs rather than do remixes or orchestral versions for this game.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind some orchestral versions of some of them. The older songs are almost unavoidably the harder ones, too.
Yeah, no kidding. I got stuck on one from Final Fantasy IV in the dark, in the chaos frame for quite a while, until last night.
So, the just a quick recap. The game's built into three modes. And the first one is series mode, and you've got to beat it first. So I'll just say first one. And what that is all the songs from that series are put into a chain, and you'll have a event song, a battle song, and a field song. Your field song is mellow. It's supposed to always be mellow. It doesn't always feel that way, but it's supposed to. And your character's walking and running, and they'll eventually chase down things like mogs, and they'll give you item. If you go fast enough, you'll meet a character from the game you're playing. And what makes the field one special is the stuff scrolls to the side, and the field one's also the only one where your position of your stylus really matters, because they have chains, and you have to move it up and down and up and down while keeping it on touch. Besides that, the position of your stylus really doesn't matter at all, as long as you're tapping and swiping right. So there is a hold, a tap, then a swipe up, down, left, right, all the diagonals. And that's it. That's everything in the game. Can you think of anything I missed that we ran into? Because there might be something later on.
Well, you might want to mention the event sections.
Oh, I will. And so those are your combinations. In the fields, you got to hold, and you move up and down on them, and tap, tap, swipe, swipe. The events, you get this nice movie in the background as you're playing, and to me, they personally feel the most like Elite Beat Agents. And what they do is you've got a circle on the screen and this track. And the track, as the circle moves around, it hits the points you're supposed to be hitting. As a circle comes to it, you swipe, and then you might hold, and then it might do circle, circle, and then bounce back. And it can get actually relatively difficult, because some of them you can't quite tell if, oh, wait a minute, is this at this part of the track or that part of the track?
Yeah, I actually think that the event songs may be some of the hardest in the game, so because I just have a lot of trouble getting the timing just right on quite a lot of those.
See, I don't have a hard time. Fields and events, I really don't have a hard time with. Battle songs, on the other hand, I have a real hard time with.
Frickin' man with a machine gun.
The ones that are like, dun 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 dun, and you're sitting there going, and it's tap, tap, swipe, left, right, tap, tap, swipe, left, right, and it doesn't feel like it registers quite right all the time. So when you're going real fast, you got to make these swipes, but they don't quite register how you think they would sometimes, but that's because you got to hold down and go to the swipe to the end and up. So you're sitting there going, is this enough time for this to register? And you'll end up missing something because you've got to rapidly tap it right afterwards. Most of the songs are fair. I haven't ran into a lot of songs that felt like they just sort of, they didn't go with the music just to make them harder. Because you know in DDR you'll get those songs like that.
Yeah. And actually, you brought up Elite Beat Agents earlier. And that's something actually I give Theatrhythm quite a bit of praise for, is that Elite Beat Agents is a brutal game. And a lot of times, if you don't know the song that they're actually doing, you're not going to pass until you fail quite a bit. In Theatrhythm, though, with the character abilities and items, it feels like they give you a chance to get through the song.
Well, even with them, I mean, I've S'd pretty much everything up to Ultimate, just because I haven't started Ultimate, and there are some songs that are pretty quite intense, but compared to Elite Beat Agents and the harder modes in DDR, well, getting S's in DDR and stuff like that, it feels really easy, to be honest. For the equivalent modes, like Expert would be two steps above Novice in DDR, then EBA, that would be the second and third guy.
Two and three star songs, yeah.
Yeah, and they feel a lot simpler than those. Because I know Elite Beat Agents, the first time I went through it, some of those later songs, just on the first level of difficulties, are pretty hard.
Don't get me started on Canned Heat. Please do not. We'll be here all night.
Yeah, that's where I'm stuck right now.
What I'm wondering here, because I don't know if anybody's played Rhythm Thief as well, how do you think that's going to handle on when the 3DS XL comes out? Because that, I haven't even tried EBA since I got my XL but from what I've heard, it's a lot harder to play because you have to move it. You have more distance to cover on the bottom screen.
Well, I think EBA would be harder on
that. At the same time, the hitboxes should be larger too, shouldn't they?
I guess so. Well, they should be. I mean, I think that for EBA, it will be harder. For Theater Rhythm, on the other hand, I think it will boil down to that it won't matter for anything but field. Because field has where you go up and down. And even if your hitboxes are larger, you're not hitting things. You're moving up and down. So you need to move it so far to make it register correctly. And you can do relatively small movements, but my first Chaos Shrine I did, I got into one field that had you going all the way around the screen a lot, and I got to the point where I had my stylus ended up being back to a corner because it was going up and down, up and down, up and down, and then it got too close to being up, and I couldn't go up anymore when next I needed to.
Yeah, a problem I run into is that there have been a couple of songs where they have you, like, tap, hold, swipe.
Yeah.
And I'll be holding it, and it won't register the swipe when I get to the end.
I tend to have more problem with tap, swipe, tap.
Yeah, that's pretty nasty, too. I've run into that several times in Man and Machine Gun.
Yeah, but it's not nearly as bad as Rhythm Thief when it comes to that. If you like Layton, and you've ever sat down, you were playing Layton, you said, man, Layton would be great if instead of puzzles I had rhythm games, just put the podcast down, go to a store, buy Rhythm Thief, play it for a while, restart podcast.
Oh, no, now you're just giving me memories. I'm just imagining Layton there going, yo, I have two matchsticks, yo.
nothing that, is there anything in Rhythm Thief that even comes close to the awesomeness of Layton disassembling a slot machine and turning it into a gun?
I don't know yet, but just hold off. They will do something crazy like that. As I said, it is a Layton game with rhythm. You still go through like any other adventure game. You go through and you tap this. You have to go each screen, and you're walking around Paris, and you have to tap the screen every time. So you go to an area, tap 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 tap. But they've introduced more wrinkles. You can get. I've gotten soundtracked coins. Phantom notes. Phantom notes are interesting because phantom notes, you click an area, a note appears. It goes, dong, and it slowly fades away. Well, to get a phantom note, you have to find all of them, and there's only about four or five, so you're hitting it like, dong. Like, where's the other one? Where's the other one? It fades away. It's like, darn it. Then you eventually find the other one, then you're like, okay, where was that one I found first?
They don't save after you get the first one?
No, they disappear. You got to remember where they're at. So to get them all, you got to make a little tune. So it's like dong, 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 and everything. And then it becomes a phantom note. But they just slowly fade. So you click one, and it slowly fades, and you got to find the next one. When you find the next one and click it, it refreshes both of them. And then you got to find the next one. That refreshes all three of them. Then you find the next one. About four is normally how many there are. You find that one, and then they all combine together to give you a phantom note.
Do you have to find them in sequence, or does it not really matter?
It doesn't really matter, which is good. If you had to find them in sequence, that would be interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, I only played the demo, and so that wasn't actually in that.
Yeah, that's all not in there. And you also find sounds in the game, and so a fountain. So you click the fountain, and suddenly there's a note, and it will play a rushing sound. And you get these sounds for multiple reasons. They're either ways to solve environmental puzzles, or they are for the ultimate musical instrument. And so the guy might say, I like things that make a gushing sound. And so what makes a gushing sound? Well, fountain makes a gushing sound. And so it will be labeled fountain, not gushing sound. And you're supposed to match the sound up. And he gives you a quick sound clip. So you're like, wait a minute, that sounds like a fountain. So you do the fountain sound. And the story is just as asinine as Layton.
That's pretty asinine, actually, considering, you know, some of the things I've seen.
Yeah, it involves Napoleon, and Phantom R is who you're playing as, Raphael. I mean, that's in the demo. And he will swap in the middle of the street from Raphael to Phantom R, and it's got to be an inside joke in this game. Phantom R is all famous and everything like that. And he keeps running into people while dressed up as Phantom R, because he has a specific uniform for that, that turn around and go, if only I could interview Phantom R and everything. It's got to be an indicted joke at this point.
Yeah, I just can't help but think, because I played the demo myself. First two parts of it were fun. Third one was just, you know, I was getting OCD trying to S-rank it. Couldn't pull it off. But I just can't help but think that this game's going to die worse than Versus 13 did.
Well, of course it did. It's being released by Sega.
Yes.
Well, Rhythm Thief is a good game, don't get me wrong, but you know how I said Theater Rhythm is easy? Rhythm Thief is hard. Oh my gosh, there's a time where I'm just going, oh my god, I got a D. I'm getting out of here.
Yeah, I think the only section I did well in the demo was the one where you had to mimic the statues, and that's because it had a really easy rhythm to
it. Yeah, it took me a couple tries. I got the statues on my second try. It took me about four or five to get through the... to get an S on the first part, but the third one, the fight sequence, that one took me, I think I played it about 15 times and couldn't get above an A.
That's not that bad. I asked all the demo before I got the game and stuff like that. My biggest problem, probably with the game, is the control input. So each challenge has its own little bit of control scheme. You pretty much either use the touchpad or you're using the buttons. It's pretty much what it boils down to. And, or the gyro. I had one where his dog was eating meat, and you're throwing meat to him, and you had a gyro in left, right, center. And the game gives you a guide and non-guide mode, but the one with the buttons, it makes me feel like my 3DS buttons aren't working correctly at times. Because you'll hit it, and you're sure you're on it, but then it will give you the harsh. And you get three or four harshes, you've automatically eaten a song. You can't recover.
I mean, you know, the demo really made me love the game, but also really, really want Theater Rhythm 2, and we're actually going to cover this a little later, you know, as I'm kind of stuck between the two of which one to get. Maybe if Theater Rhythm ever gets some download content for some Final Fantasy XI music, primarily a theme from Sanctuary of Zeta, which is the best song in that game as far as anything else is concerned in there. Yeah, Rhythm Thief was really fun from what I played on the demo.
Rhythm Thief, I'd probably pick up Theater Rhythm to tell you the truth. And Rhythm Thief, I would buy once it's got discounted a little bit. Because it is fun, but it does suffer from... There is a lot of time between the rhythm games. So, it's not a bad game. I really think somebody should have done more QA testing on the button games. Because they don't feel as good as the other ones. They don't feel... Like, the controls on those just don't feel as good as the other Rhythm Thief games. And especially not as good as Theater Rhythm's controls.
Yeah, and... Ryan, that was Sanctuary of Zeta was the one you're looking for? Because I think that's actually coming out on the 26th for Theater Rhythm.
Is it?
Yeah.
And I can die a happy man.
Yeah.
No, you can't. You got to edit this.
Well, of course.
Thankfully, that song comes out after the edit. Whether that one from Versus 13 that's out in Japan, whether that makes it over here before Final Fantasy Versus 13, it's...
That's already out. I have that song.
Yeah, so get it while you can, folks, because it may not be there much longer. They may just... deny it ever existed.
Yeah, the one that hasn't made it over here is the one that they did for Type Zero.
Allegedly, that was supposed to be localized, but really, at this point, I think they'd probably better just do an international version on the Vita and release it that way. Because unless you're named Atlas or Xseed, you're not getting a PSP game out in North America at this point.
And Valkyria Chronicles 3, please, while they're at it.
Bad news.
Yeah, I know. I'm dreaming. It's Sega.
We can put a pin in that one, too.
Okay, my last game, which I seem to be taking an inordinate amount of time on this one, is Skylanders, and I just want to mention it because I've got... Now I have every figurine but Whamshell, and we just did the last expansion. And the reason I really want to mention that game is that my son likes to play it, and it's sort of interesting being one of the few games that a four-year-old can play in this house. Considering everything else I've talked about. Good game. I recommend it to anybody, especially to play with their kids. And if you have a 3DS, wholeheartedly recommend the 3DS version.
Yeah, it's always good to have games that kids can play with you. That's a lot of the reason why I stood up so hard for Sorcery on the PS3. Same reason. I mean, you got to have something that kids can play with you.
It's hard to find games nowadays that you can really play with your kids, especially ones that are somewhat interesting.
I don't know, Far Cry 3 looks like a good one.
My son actually watched me play quite a bit of Mass Effect, not really because I wanted him to, but...
You didn't usher him out of the room for the really, you know...
I have no place to usher him to.
Oh, and this is why I'm still single.
But yeah, so he was right there, and it's like he insisted that my Shepard have the mask on. Because one of the armor types has a mask that pretty much reduces you to this mask head and glowing eyes. And he insisted, because I had her in something else, like, I want her in the mask one, Daddy. Like, okay, can you put her in the mask one?
Yeah, by the way, nice thing that they added for Mass Effect 3. You can have conversations with your helmet on, and he'll take it off when he talks to people.
Yeah. So, I hear you've been doing things there, Donald.
Yeah.
Some Pokemon.
Yeah. I imported and then proceeded to rip so I could play it on my current DS. Thank you for that still being legal in Canada, at least for the next few days. I picked up Pokemon White 2. I was one of the 2 million people that bought it in the first couple of weeks. It's very similar to the other games, like, you know, still same core game structure, you know, 8 badges. They bring back the Elite Four. You actually do the first half of the game ends once you beat the champion. Thing is with me, Pokemon's sort of the default game. It's the one I go to whenever I'm just bored, because I have a certain OCD about trying to fill the Pokedex. I did manage to get it to 646, which is with all the legally released Pokemon back within 2 weeks of White coming out recently. I'm really not sure whether White 2 is a third version or, you know, a sequel, because there's no new Pokemon in it. They bring back about 130 old ones. And let me tell you, I just about threw my DS across the room when a wild Zubat appeared.
Oh, Lord.
Yes, he's back. Just when you thought it was safe to walk into a cave, here comes the Zubat again.
The Zubat-Geodude combo?
Zubat, yes. Geodude, actually, no. But
wow.
There are Pokemon that fill similar roles. Like, there is a rock type. Thankfully, he's not immune to electricity, so you can actually, if you have an electric, you can still beat him up. But half the time, they have something like that ability your mechanical WoW pet has, that it will survive a one hit kill with one hit point left.
That's honestly why. That's actually part of the reason I have not gone through a Pokemon game since after the advanced ones, because I got so tired of the first beginning, and it was like, oh, look, it's cave time. Look, there's a Zubat and Geodude. Okay, time to stop this game.
Yeah, the first for White 1, there's still a bat, there's still a rock, but they're different. Like,
it's the one with the happy nose. Isn't
yeah,
it?
It's the one with the little heart nose.
And, yeah, I have a toy of him.
Yeah, and if you're picking this up, I'd say for the first half of the game, like anything before the Elite Four, it's about 50-50 between it being stuff you would have played in Black or White and new areas. Like, you start in a new town, you still get the same starters, but the first quarter of the game, and even the areas you're going back to, there's new side areas for them. Like, there's a place where you can actually catch Wild Eevee. Yippee. If you're into that sort of thing. They've actually put an achievement system in as well. So there's a lot, like all these medals that you can get as you're going through the game, like for, you know, take 5,000 steps, save the game. Unless you're in Japan, there is no bloody way you're going to complete all the achievements, because some of them include battle 2,000 times in link battles, or get 1,000 tags in the game's tag mode.
Ugh.
Yeah, so I don't know if we want to organize the party at PAX East now, so we can possibly complete that, because they've really taken some steps to try to cram a lot of fan service in. Like, they've brought back a lot of the old ones, and unfortunately they also brought Zubat back. But like, you can get first time in the game, at least you can walk into a normal area and any time get an Eevee. You can connect it up with Black and White 1, then it'll actually upload the ability to catch the Pokemon of your main antagonist from Black and White 1, and those Pokemon are really good. Like, they're considered trained, like owned by another trainer, so they grow faster and they have really good stats built into them. There's also a tournament mode, which sort of replaces what they normally put a battle frontier in the new versions, but instead they have this tournament, and you get to battle every old gym leader, including the ones from the first, you know, every generation of games is in there, and you get to beat up on Red one more time. The last thing I'll sort of mention here is that they actually have, once you beat the game, you unlock a key that you can send to another game that will put it into assist mode, which would be suitable for Steven's Son, or Challenge Mode, which is how I'm playing it now. Challenge Mode isn't... They up the levels on the trainers. They don't really do anything with wild Pokemon, so you have to... Basically, you have to do a bit more grinding. And the... But I pretty much... It wasn't any harder for me than it was to play it through normally. And that's with... For half of the first run through, not having any knowledge of what moves I was actually using.
Now, for me, I played Pokemon very rarely. I joined on with Yellow, then many years later got Pearl. Is there enough in Black 2, White 2 to recommend upgrading to that from, you know, Diamond and Pearl?
Well, for one thing, Diamond and Pearl are so ungodly slow that you'll actually... Because they do a lot of things to speed up the game. Like, you'll be able to get through it a lot quicker because they have... there's a... Like, not only are, like I said, Diamond and Pearl, their text in that game is terrible. And the surfing speed and movement speed is just bad. It's really increased now. Like, they've made a lot of things to make the experience easier for you. Like, you have a shortcut to the quick stuff in the... Like, you can shortcut certain items, like your bicycle or, like, the item finder you can keep on. And you can also do that into the... And it's one button into the... One option into the Pokemon menu, so you can make those swaps pretty quickly. I'd certainly encourage you to try it. I would probably at this point hold off until Black 2 comes, until they come out in North America. That's first Sunday in October, I think, is when it comes out. Certainly give it a shot. You might, who knows, you may find that one Pokemon that you really like that you want to. You decide you want to go through the game with it, because there's a lot of new ones and there's some pretty cool ones to try out, and they're like the giant electric tarantula that's basically my new favorite Pokemon.
Yeah, because going through Pearl, I found that I was pretty much just reassembling the team I used back in Yellow, and with the only difference being that I think I swapped out my Alakazam for an Espeon.
Yeah.
Well, Donald, one question for you then. Is Pikachu in the game?
He's not, actually.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Then.
He's you have.
Well, that's a surprise.
You have to. They've really gone with like the cover legendaries as the mascots for the games recently, especially when in this game the cover legendary does try to kill your main character, like not attack your Pokemon. He's got a circle of icicles headed right for your neck at one point.
Interesting.
So the storylines are getting a little more mature. I don't know what they've changed from Black to White, but the end villain in Black and White is a complete monster. I think he's gone even more insane now. I just can't tell. I won't really be able to tell until I've actually had a chance to play the North American version, which I'll probably sell my Japanese one at that point and just get the North American one when it comes out.
Before we go too on, I sort of got a question about the beginning. Actually, two questions. One is, in the beginning of most Pokemon games I've played, you pretty much, let's say Bidoff was one of them all at the beginning. You just keep running into the same Pokemon over and over, so you're sort of forced to have your team by the first gym is almost dictated for you, because you're sort of forced into these ones. Is there more variety to begin with?
Yeah, like, with, you can actually build, if you took the like, if you take T-Pig, the fire starter, you can have a full team ready to go before you go to the first gym. There's just the third area you go to has a Psyduck. It has the baby Meryl, and you've been able to pick up a pretty good grass type. And there's also the Marowak, the electric sheep from Gold and Silver, and the baby form of Lucario, all within the first couple of routes. So you can have a really good team, but there is a lot of ones as you go through the game. Like, anything on Route 4 is at least usable, if not outright broken, in the case of one of the fire monkeys.
Is there a Farfetch'd?
Post-game. Like, he's a swarmer. For flying types, there's a pretty good... If you get White, they're the exclusive flying type you get in that game, though. It looks like a giant bald eagle, and it's really powerful. So the only way I've ever been able to use Farfetch'd is in a fan hack that turned him into a fighting type and basically doubled his attack and speed.
Really? I used Farfetch'd in the original one, Yellow, and Gold and Silver to cremate people.
Yeah. Yeah, he's like I said, having him, because fighting flying is a unique, he would make him a unique type. He learned in this hacked version, he learned a lot of moves that you'd certainly cremate, but they've jacked up the Pokemon, every other Pokemon in that game anyway, so.
Yeah, and I guess my other question would be, is that the gym battles, you still have to do every gym. There's not more gyms than what you actually need to do the end game.
Yeah, they stuck with 8 gyms. I don't really think I think 8 is about the most you can really do. But like you said, you have the opportunity, even before the end game, to battle all the old gym leaders if you want. So there is a way to face off against a wide variety of trainers. It's restricted battling, like it's a 3-on-3. But the main thing with the challenge mode is that they'll actually give the gym leaders, they'll make the gym leaders are really where they've upped the challenge. Like they'll put the first gym's normal. Normally you bring out the baby Lucario, you win by default, but in challenge mode, they put a flying type in there that's also part normal, so it's still within the realm of the gym, and he will basically wipe out your fighting type unless you make a quick switch.
Yeah, I've always thought it was, and particularly in the Pokemon series, I always thought they really needed more gyms than what you needed, because you should be able to do a journey and be like, oh yeah, I did the poison, flying, fire, water one, and someone else did the ice, steel, psychic, dark ones.
Yeah.
Actually, they still don't have a dark one, do they?
Only dark leaders have been Elite Four. I don't know why that's the one thing I was hoping for with this round, and, well, maybe next time around, but dark is sort of the name for it in Japanese. It actually translates to evil, so I can see why they would want to hold off on that, because it's considered the most powerful type, but probably too strong for a gym.
Did they add any 3DS-specific features to this game, a la Link's Awakening on the Game Boy Color?
There hasn't really been anything. The closest thing is that it'll connect to the Pokemon Dream Radar. So the Dream Radar app is like a $3 eShop app that's only out in Japan now. It'll come out here with Black 2 and White 2. And that has some alternate, some AR things you can use to catch Pokemon with. And those Pokemon can actually be brought back into Black and White 2. So I don't think they're going to be doing remakes this time around. I think they're going to hold off on that until the 3DS comes out. So it's still 5 games for the generation, but it's 4 games plus a 3DS app. And there is some exclusive Pokemon you can only get through that app.
Okay, so yeah, I see you've got another game on our notes.
Yeah, there's a couple of other things I do. The other sort of my other tradition is actually I'm trying to get on Jeopardy. I've always been really good at trivia games. So instead of playing it on the Wii, I actually set up in the show notes, there's a link to a spreadsheet that I do to basically, I watch the show every day, I DVR it. I'll sort of play against the contestants that are on the show and try to see if I can get the clues before they do, try to get the rebound. Because before, I wouldn't have been able to try to get on the show. I'd have to fly to LA to take the test, but they actually have it online now. So I was actually able to take it this year, and I'm pretty I haven't heard back, but I'm pretty sure I was a couple of questions away from actually passing and possibly going to an audition for the show. And basically that little thing is you keep, if you play along, if you can average about $25,000 of worth of questions right, you're probably going to be able to do all right and get onto that. So I've done the spreadsheet up on Google Docs, and I'll put that in the show thread if it's not already in the show notes. The last thing I'm really going to talk about, it's more of a warning. For the love of God, do not play Final Fantasy II unless you're playing it in Theater Rhythm. Because...
Indeed.
Yes. My New Year's resolution this year, I wanted to see if I could beat all the numbered Final Fantasy single-player games. So I was going to put 10-2 and 13-2 in for where 11 and 14 would go. No offense, Ryan, but I'm just not an MMO guy.
You have chosen... wisely.
Yeah. So I had about 8, based on that, I had about 8 left. I decided, I found a copy of the PSP version of Final Fantasy II for $3 at a thrift store. I still overpaid for it.
I think you overpaid, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely overpaid for it. Because Final Fantasy II, you have to break that game. Otherwise, it will go out of its way to screw you at every single opportunity. I haven't seen some of the bullcrap that it pulls since Pokemon Stadium 1. on the N64, and that game blatantly cheated at some points. The
yes,
yeah,
the surfing rock type.
Yeah, surfing rock type. not what I'm worried about. Pokemon with illegal movesets, and that could get a critical hit 98% of the time. That's what I had a problem with. But the worst thing that I actually had happen to me during the course of the game, I had one of my characters get frogged about halfway through. I used the Maiden's Kiss item, which is supposed to cure frog. It missed twice in a row. I've never in my life seen an RPG item miss until Final Fantasy II.
The first D&D game I ever tried to Dungeon Master, I got the advanced set in Series 2. Everything, I was a kid, everything has an innate hit thing. This will become important to the story. So everything just has a base. This is what it takes to hit it. Well, someone was trying to fall to the floor. Well, the floor effectively has an innate hit chance, if you read the rule that way. The guy rolled, he critically missed. He critically missed the floor.
What is this, Ultima 3?
So I had to float, which Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has clearly stated that if you miss the floor, you have to fly.
Yeah,
so
secret. Yeah, that's a secret to fly and throw yourself to the ground and miss. But I don't know if I've never had that happen to me in playing 1. I played the PSP version of 2. I'm worried, honestly, that the screwing could have been even worse, especially since that in other versions, apparently your stats go down if you don't use them. But I think the other part that really, really ground my gears was, you know, right before the end game, they throw a new party member at you, and he was useless until about 2 battles before the Emperor, like the final boss of the game. Because he was supposed to be, he was a previous boss who you end up beating to have him join your side, so you would think that he would be, you know, he would have a good spell selection. He had good weapons, but his best stats were his magic, and he had no magic. And if I tried to build him up, he unfortunately had the habit of falling over and dying in a hit. Like, I think I burned about, if I didn't cheat to get, you know, a million gil 20 hours earlier, I would not have been able to get through that final dungeon, because I spent most of that money on Phoenix Downs in the final part. Do yourself a favor. Do not play Final Fantasy II. I will never play it again unless someone offers me 6 figures, literally. So if that happens, you can see it on Kickstarter.
So are those 6 of Zach's figures with the big...
No, we're talking Reggie's annual salary, maybe times 3.
But he needs that to feed his big giant sea monster.
Just feed it the non-specific action figure.
And the people that go with it.
Oh, you'll always be my friend.
So, anything else you want to talk about?
Not really. I think, Ryan, have you got anything you wanted to talk about?
Yes, have been playing a particular RPG that I imported last year. Xenoblade, How I Love Thee. I'm about 120 hours in now. I feel like I'm maybe 3/4 of the way through the game. And the thing that I love most about this game is the art style. Johnny touched on this last week, how when you come to a new area, like, nothing feels repetitive, because every area you come to is so distinct, and so the artistic design that they've created in the game. Even 120 hours in, I'm not tired.
Yeah, and not only that, but that not only does every area look new, but it also looks new depending on which daytime cycle that you're in, because most of the areas look radically different at night.
Yeah, and that whole day-night cycle is incorporated really well into the quest system. I've read up that there's like 476, 480, somewhere in there, quests in the game. And I feel like I've got to be close to the 400 count mark. I don't know, it's just... And I love that that's linked to the affinity system in the game and how your characters react with one another as you progress. Because of this, Dunbon has turned into my favorite character, although I play the most as Melia, just because if you don't play as her and keep her as just a CPU character, you don't get to see the full capabilities that she can exert upon enemies. And so I really love Melia and her magic burst system. Play the game. I don't know if others have, but I played the game with the Japanese voices and English subs. I've noticed a few discrepancies. I don't know Japanese really well, but there are a few things that I can pick up on, and some of the translations in the game are incorrect. And that kind of irks me when I come across stuff.
You get that and everything like that. And if you watch a lot of anime, and especially if you watch a series that's been fan subs, you watch it fan sub, and then you watch the original, the sub they put out, and then you listen to the voice acting, if you've ever done all three, you'll notice that somehow or another from the translation, you'll have this fan sub that is very, very close to the Japanese. Then the subtext on the American release and the words that the people are actually saying, if you do the subtext and the English words, just so you understand both, you'll notice the subtext is not nearly as good as the fan sub, and they'll just totally blatantly just switch things and stuff like that. It's a fairly common problem.
Yeah, I've noticed this with Naruto, actually, Naruto Shippuden. I watch a fan sub version of it, which is pretty exact, and then I've tried to watch a few episodes that Viz Media creates, and it's awful. I don't like it at all.
I had to jump off on over to it, Shibutin, because I was so disappointed from all the filler. But anyway, before that. Yeah. But anyway.
The thing about localization, though, is that it's not usually so much that the translation is wrong, but that there are many ways you could translate it, and they just picked a way that maybe sounded more natural.
True,
Yeah, you can do you can do it straight, or you can basically do like what 8-4 does in Glory of Heracles and just take the piss out of everything.
Or you can do like Kid Icarus.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that later.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, I think Xenoblade, you're playing the European version, correct?
Yes. So am I.
Which I think that's what we got here in the States and everything. But I think it's sort of a double culture thing, because not only did you have the Japanese culture influence, but then you have the European translation and everything. Even though it is English, well, petrol and gas are the same word, and we don't use petrol here in the States. It's just, there's cultural differences in Europe as well from the United States, and so you sort of double up on those, like copy of a copy type deal.
Well, my favorite aspect of the game actually is the battle system, and I say this because the battle system in this game and in the battle system in Final Fantasy XIV are pretty identical. And I've loved the changes that have been made in 14 leading up to 2.0's release this fall. They've incorporated a lot of that, like with the being able to click on the icons and having a set characteristic icon that your character can click, like say when it gets, you know, when you get full
heat.
Yeah, sure. And then you're able to use that, and you can see your, like with Shulk, he goes into, you know, the full on Monado mode, and there's aspects now, like that being built into 14 now with the different job system. And so I really love that about Xenoblade, how each character's ability set is really unique. But I also have a gripe too, because whenever I do come across a new area, you know, you're either, if you've been doing enough quests, you're either a level or two, or if you've done enough like I have, you're much, much higher level than some of the just the regular basic mobs that are scattered about the playfield there. There's really no strategy at all. And the only time that I really have a blast playing is when I'm fighting NMs, the notorious monsters, or fighting any of the bosses, and that's when you get more strategy. And it's like I almost want to plow through and get to that point, but at the same time I don't want to advance the story too much because I'm so concerned about finishing every single freaking quest.
Yeah, I'm a pretty bad completionist as well. I've run into the same problem that you have, and that completionism is probably the reason I stopped playing at one point.
I was worried that I was getting in too much, although you know, playing Final Fantasy II beforehand didn't help. But when I got the game, but I've only put a couple of hours into it at this point. I keep telling myself I should go back and, you know, get through it again. But I don't I want to get 100% completion on it. And I know, and if you're 120 hours and you're 3/4 of the way through the game, I've got a life, but I don't have, you know, that's about a 2-month project for me. And I've only got one TV that I'd be able to play it on.
Oh, Lord, that would be more than that. That would probably be a good solid year for me, considering it's not on a handheld.
Probably won't beat it until November. We'll see. But I do have a question for you guys who have played it. The chain system, I'm sometimes confused about how it works. Like, what abilities you can use to link. Are there certain abilities that you have to use, or is it based on how much of the meter you have full in the chain gauge?
Yeah, I think there are two components to it. The first is that you have a higher chance of linking to another character if you use an ability that's the same color as the one that came before it. But also the game looks at your affinity between teammates, and if your affinity is high enough, it just keeps going.
Well, like I said, you know, just regular basic mobs as you're going through it, I'm so high leveled now compared to them, I just don't ever really get a chance to see that, and so I don't get to until I fight NMs or boss fights, so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I really need to get back to that game, but I got to the point in the game where you reach Sword Valley, and there was a major plot revelation before that point that it really turned me off from the game for a while, because I thought it negated one of the most powerful moments in the game beforehand. And it's like, oh, we're really going there, game. You know, I really love that game. I love the freedom that it gives you and the imagination and the environments, though. When you think about it, the environments don't really make any sense when it comes to being on these giants. I mean, you start at the underside of the leg, which is a nice temperate zone. Then you move up on top of the leg, and it's very windy. You move on to the back, and it's extremely hot. You move on to the shoulder, and it's snowing.
It's dandruff. That's what it is.
Huh.
It's higher.
Yeah. Yeah, but you go even higher than that. You go up even higher, though, and it's beach. On top of the head, it's all beach and seaside.
It's got a lot to think about up there, I mean.
Yeah, but it's a great game. I'll get back to playing it someday.
There is a ton. I'm loving it, though.
Just way too much content there.
That is a nasty game to have in your backlog, though, just knowing that you're looking at that's 100, you have to invest 100 hours at minimum to get through it.
Yeah, I think I'm at 100 where I am, but that's, I invested all that time into quests.
Well, as far as what else, I've been playing Limbo. Actually, I finished Limbo a couple weeks ago, but I do want to talk about it. You know, for those who haven't played Limbo, you know, it's a graphically atmospheric black and white game where you're a little boy traversing all these puzzle-based rooms, landscapes, you know, looking for your sister, trying to find out what happened to her.
That's what you're doing? I thought you were just a little boy that was stuck out there where your parents accidentally left you and not taught you to swim.
Yeah. The only reason you would know the story of that game is if you read it on the marketplace.
I did.
I didn't.
I thought that was the one with the time travel, but I get all those indie puzzle platformers with unique art styles confused.
Don't
anyway.
Worry, not being able to remember what Braid is a very good thing.
I did not enjoy Braid. I really didn't.
Nor did I.
Yeah, I just didn't. I had so much hype for that, but yeah. As far as Limbo, you know, some people feel the game has a stunted length to it, being really short. I disagree, mainly because of the puzzle difficulty. It really. All I put in was about 3 hours, and really that's all I needed to enjoy the game. So that's why I don't feel like it has a stunted length. It's just so much retrying and retrying.
Yeah, I thought that was a great game to play with a partner. You know, I was towards the end of that game, and my best friend had come over, and I wanted to show him the game. And we worked together on quite a few of those last puzzles where things can get really confusing with gravity switches and the rooms rotating and things like that. So it's a really good game to play with, you know, someone you care about.
Yeah. Oh, that last puzzle made me pull my hair out. I just could not get it.
I thought the game broke the first time that happened because it goes into that super slow-mo as you do the last move. And I thought, did I just break my 360?
I could see that. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, something that I played the 360 and the PS3 version of that game at one point. Something I'll be curious to hear at one point is there was a special level that was put into the PS3 version, and I know it had to be new because the 360 didn't have an achievement for it, but the PS3 version did. Is they gave you a new challenge, and I really wish that the game itself had normally done this, but there's a secret area in the game that you can access on the PS3 version about halfway through where you drop into a cave and it's total darkness. All you can see is your character's eyes. And then the game will have you navigating over obstacles using nothing but sound. So you'll hear like whirling blades coming down and clashing on the ground in front of you. And you have to listen for when the whirling blades go up and so you know to run past them and you know, guns going off and stuff. It's a really interesting level. If they have it in the Steam version, I suggest you try and find it.
I'll have to do that thing.
It's brutally hard, but it's very rewarding.
Yeah.
I just got to get past the mind-controlling worm.
Which
worm? Where I'm at right now. The first one.
Yeah, you've got a lot more fun with that coming up.
It's quite a lot of aggravation there, yeah.
Oh, fun. I'm assuming the worms eat it, because I saw them eating mind control worms the other time, the ones that come from the ceiling, but meh.
You remember that secret level I told you about? It has a mind control worm in it.
It has mind control worms?
So you're dodging things in the dark, using nothing but sound with a mind control worm pushing you forward. So, you know, I hear that you've been playing a very popular 3DS game lately.
Super Monkey Ball 3D, right?
You got it. That's the one. No, I've been playing a little Kid Icarus Uprising. For me, this is really interesting because I'm left-handed, and so I absolutely do need the Circle Pad Pro. I will say it is very, very awkward to move your character with your right thumb when we've been trained for so long to move your character with your left thumb. It took me.
Does the stand work with that version?
With the Circle Pad Pro?
Yeah. I mean, does the Circle Pad Pro fit on it?
You can, but I mean, it's kind of wobbly. It's not. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't hold itself in place really well. But stand really is not a problem for me. I'm usually laying back on a couch and just have my elbows propped up to where I can hold the pretty stationary.
I didn't need any prompting or anything. I just held my 3DS like I normally held my 3DS and everything when I played Kid Icarus.
Well, you're not left. Are you left-handed, though?
Did you say you had a Circle Pad Pro?
Yeah, yeah.
It should be about the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not. It's not much heavier. It's not a big deal. It does kind of make me wish that there might have been dual analog control built into the game, just to see how that would work. I know that wouldn't.
And it's really weird because there's actually an option in the game already that's kind of like dual analog, where you can use the face buttons.
Oh yeah, yeah.
In the place of the touchpad.
I've actually got a friend that plays it that way, and I'm amazed that he does.
Well, I played through parts of the game in first person mode. And everything. Actually, that's what I end up doing. I go in the ground phase, and when I'm in the ground phase, I go into the first-person mode, and I find it's easier to control that way. But if you have a really homing weapon, at that point, you don't even really need to use the stylus for the most part anymore. You just sort of need to strafe around correct.
Yeah, I really like that game. I've gotten as far as I just beat Thanatos.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's a lot of fun. I have major issues with the ground controls. I think I love the music. For me, a little rule of thumb I have is that if I start the game and they got the music right, chances are they got the rest of the game right too.
Oh yeah,
because no one pays attention to the music.
Oh, the music is fantastic too. I mean, and then the witty banter between Palutena and Pit, just it makes it complete. I love it.
Yeah, they walk the fence so tightly on that, because that could have turned out really badly.
Yeah.
And yet it comes off as really charming.
That's what sold me on the game, is when I saw the demo. I had no interest in Kid Icarus at all when it first got told. It's like, Kid Icarus, I'm like, okay, I played the Game Boy game. I don't know if I really want to play another Kid Icarus ever. And so, but then the video came out, and they had that back and forth with Palutena and everything like that. And that what actually sold me on the game right there. It wasn't any of the gameplay. It was that dialogue back and forth, because I really do enjoy getting story that way.
Yeah, I love the running gag in the game that Palutena is really full of it. And she pretends to be a lot more powerful and wise than she actually is.
So have any of you guys been able to do majority of the stages on say, the 9.0 difficulty?
No.
I haven't tried it.
I did the first one. I really farmed the first few levels when I got the game, and I've done them at 9.0 difficulty, but I really need to sit down and actually totally beat that game, because I keep getting to a level, and then I want to farm it to the mm-hmm. point where I can unlock all the areas.
Oh, yeah.
And some of the later ones, that's pretty hard.
Well, I've done that just on the first several stages, probably three or four stages I've been able to complete on 9.0. My average is 5.5, which I'm actually quite pleased with, because the later stages in the game get absolutely absurd with how much they throw at you. I had a really interesting situation with this game, because I used the Circle Pad Pro. I was in a boss fight. I was playing, I think it was like probably on a 7 difficulty or whatever, so it was pretty tough. I had entered the boss room without grabbing the drink of the gods, and so I just barely had enough health, maybe for two hits, and I would have been gone. So I was in the boss fight, and I had already gotten a warning when I started the game that, you know, my battery in my Circle Pad Pro was running out, so I needed to change it soon. I get in this boss fight, and I'm fighting the boss, and I've probably delivered enough hits to where I've got maybe just a couple more to go, and it's gone. My Circle Pad Pro dies on me. And so
Did it pause the game?
Yes. So for the first time since being a little kid playing video games, I had a sweaty palms moment, freaking out, trying to find a battery, put this thing back in, hoping that right when I continue my game, I won't get hit. Because I had a shot coming at me. I put the battery in, got the game going, dodged. I don't know how I dodged, but delivered one hit. One hit, and the enemy, the boss, was dead.
Nice.
And, yeah. I was quite proud of that moment. Like, that's probably not going to happen for a long, long time ever again. So, but yeah, I love the multiplayer. I've taken part in a couple of the NWR community nights. I missed the last one, though, which is a shame, because I really wanted to take part in it, but I had work obligations to do. But do you guys have any strategies for playing online? Is there anything particular? It's really chaotic.
Yeah, for me, it's a little free-for-all. I mean, it's conceptually-wise, it's good. If you can get a team on Vent, Skype, whatever, it's pretty clear you can dominate just by just that little bit of coordination. But even then, it's somewhat frantic. I actually do enjoy it. It really takes advantage of all the different weapons and their strengths and weaknesses, which he put in a ton of weapons, a lot more than the game actually called for in its design, which is fine for me.
Yeah, I know.
That really makes the multiplayer interesting.
They've kind of complained about that on RFN, about there being way too many weapons. But I love it, though. I love that Sakurai has thrown so much at us. It makes me actually very excited for the next Smash Brothers too. So,
and there's achievements for using certain weapons and stuff like that, and clearing stages certain ways.
Yeah,
and the achievement system is probably the unspoken hero in this game. That achievement system is actually pretty good, where you unlock the pictures, there's music, there's videos, there's just tons of different things you can do, and while you're playing at least first through it, you do a pretty just naturally have a steady flow of achievements coming at a pretty good pace, where you're not feeling like you're starved for some reaffirmation. You're actually doing something.
Yeah. And you know, Nintendo's been doing that with a lot of games lately, putting in like built-in game achievements and just for that game in particular. And that kind of has me really excited for what the Wii U might be able to do.
Yeah, I'm hoping they take I'm hoping they use the Kid Icarus approach when they do the whole system-wide version, instead of something cutesy like a sticker book. Okay, but I'd rather unlock a big portrait.
Yeah. Did you find yourself using abilities that often? Because one of my problems with the controls is that they have you in the midst of battle. You've got your left hand on the circle pad, you got your right hand on the stylus, and they want you to, while you're moving around, cycle through your abilities with the D-pad and then tap the screen. It comes off as very awkward, so I usually end up just only using the healing abilities in boss fights and whatnot. It's one of the reasons I wish they had given you the option for dual analog control, because then it might have freed them up to maybe use buttons for the abilities, or to give Pit more abilities than things he would have to use items for, like being able to jump or dash, be able to run on command rather than kind of rely on the maybe it'll work, maybe it won't dash system.
Does the Circle Pad Pro, does it use the extra, does Kid Icarus use the extra buttons that the Pro gives at all, or is it just the extra analog stick that it'd be using?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see, I'm looking at it right now. The ZR trigger is what you used to shoot, and the R button is used to, well, the way I've got it mapped, I've got the R button mapped to activate your power in any item. I have a weird configuration. You just mentioned that, Austin, because I have, it's weird. I have the item forward and item backward navigation set to the A and X buttons, and so I can kind of lean my thumb off of the right circle pad and tap X or A to pick whichever power, and then just trigger it with my right index finger. So it's kind of wonky, but it works for me.
Okay, that sounds great then. I see you've been playing some Marvel Pinball there on the 3DS.
Yeah, Marvel Pinball is a lot like Zen Pinball, at least from everything that I've read. I haven't played Zen Pinball yet, but I've heard from enough people that it's pretty similar. I'm enjoying it. I'm a pinball fanatic. I've loved pinball ever since I was a little kid. I get starry-eyed whenever I'd come across a pinball table out in the wild.
Do you get blind, mute, and dumb?
Sometimes.
There's not that many out in the wild anymore.
Last one I saw was actually at my university's bar.
My favorite, my favorite pinball table is the Addams Family. I loved that one when I was a kid.
That's not a bad table. It's a pretty good one.
Yeah,
it's fun.
You might see that table come back at some point. The folks who do it in the Pinball Arcade, they've hinted rather strongly that they're going to try and get Addams Family at some point.
Yeah.
Because they just got Twilight Zone through their Kickstarter.
Didn't they try to get Star Trek, too?
Yeah, but unfortunately people started pulling their donations because it looked like we weren't going to make it to the stretch goal. And so we fell way short of where we needed to be. But they said that the next Kickstarter they're going to do, and they're going to do it right this time, is going to be Star Trek The Next Generation. Because they obviously, when they did the Twilight Zone Kickstarter, they didn't know what they were doing. And so they kept changing things as it went along, and it just got messy. But so what do you think of the 3DS version of the game?
Well, I'm enjoying it. Graphically, it's impressive. I like it. Good ball physics and just overall the way the game functions. I can't get comfortable with the camera, though. I know there's like 8 different cameras, but I cannot get comfortable with one. I've settled on 5, camera number 5. It's still, I don't know, something about it just drives me crazy.
Yeah, I think on the PS3 version I used 2, if I remember right. It zooms in when the ball goes up, but otherwise it pans out.
I'm trying to remember which one, because Zen Pinball had the same problem with trying to keep the camera straight, and I try to get it as close to like an overhead view as possible, because I think that's I played more video pinball than real pinball, so I'm more used to seeing, you know, just have a straight up view of one screen of the table. I could never really get it to where I wanted it to be, so I guess that's why I haven't played Zen Pinball, and you know, I don't really care for comics, so Marvel, putting Marvel skin on it doesn't really appeal to me that much.
On the PS3 version, the big complaint I have with the game, especially in comparison to Pinball Arcade, is that the tables are pretty, they're fun to play, but I have no earthly idea what I'm doing when I start playing those tables, especially the new ones that you're going to get as DLC at some point, the Avengers tables.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty and they do some interesting things, but I could not tell you what you have to do on those tables for the life of me. I'd heard that there was a guide feature on the 3DS version that gave you instructions as to what happens when you put the ball where.
Yes, I was just about to say that. It built into the options. It's a couple button presses away. You have to start the table, hit pause, and then go into options, and then you'll see it right there. And it'll show like each mission objective and where you've got to hit the ball and everything. And I thought that was pretty impressive, but I kind of wish that would have been like right when you activate the table, and then maybe you could skip it. Or, you know, just to proceed to the game.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think the HD console versions have the guide yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that really irks me, because I'll play Pinball Arcade and they'll have these detailed, like, step-by-step instructions for everything you can do on the table, but no such thing for Pinball Arcade, for Marvel Pinball.
Yeah. Well, I love the online leaderboards for the game. I've been competing with a couple of the friends on my 3DS roster, so that keeps me going in the game.
Yeah, that's a pretty addictive feature where it'll say, oh, you're only, you know, 30,000 points away from beating one of your friends.
Yeah,
keep going.
Almost got it, yeah. Well, as far as the other one, I've been playing Kirby's Pinball Land. You know, it was just released on the eShop. I feel like it's aged well and played it pretty hardcore when I was a kid, was able to complete every table and do everything you have to do to finish them out. But now it's a little bit difficult for me, and I don't know if it's just because of age it's just a little bit more difficult now.
It's being used to those slick modern ball physics in your Marvel Pinball.
I guess so. Yeah. No, but I love the layered boards and how, you know, it's kind of like a three tier, and then you've got the boss battle and everything. I love all of that. I like the randomness during the boss fights. I mean, sometimes it's uncontrollable that you'll get sucked back down into the third tier and just have to, you know, restart and make your way back up. That aspect's really fun for me.
Yeah, is there more than the one table in that game?
Yes.
There's 3 tables, I think, because for one for the three main bosses, I think Wispy Woods, is it Krakow and La 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 La? I think is it. I played Kirby Pinball few years back. I had a good time with it, although the release of Kirby Pinball on 3DS Virtual Console just makes me wish they'd put Pokemon Pinball out, or even put Pinball Ruby and Sapphire, maybe have that have been one of the ambassador games instead of maybe Mario Kart.
I heard the Metroid Pinball game was pretty good too. I actually got a weird question for you about Kirby Pinball. Now that I think about it, how do you think the Kirby Pinball and Canvas Curse, you remember for the DS?
Yes.
Where
yes.
he turned into the ball and you had to move around?
Mm-hmm.
Does he, was the physics in that a lot like what they originally used in Kirby Pinball?
You know, kind of. I mean, now you think about it. Kirby will say, like, you're right on top of the gutter, and Kirby will, you know, where's he going to go? Is he going to fall back into the main portion, or is he going to fall out and then down to the very bottom? Though the way he moves is pretty much that. It feels like it anyway, because I know in Canvas Curse, when you draw a line like that, I mean, the physics will slowly move him over.
Yeah, he's sort of floaty, but Kirby's always been a floaty character. I mean, even in his actual mainline games, that's one of his hallmarks. He's very mm-hmm. floaty and relatively indestructible.
Yeah, that's kind of a problem in a pinball game, though. That's really my main problem with the game, because I played a little bit of it on the 3DS Virtual Console, and I can't really get a good feeling of momentum in that game, and momentum is everything in a pinball game. So, yeah. Maybe it gets a lot better, but I just couldn't get into it.
No, our beloved site director, Neil, made a comment on Twitter the other day about the gutters feeling magnetized. Like, Kirby always gets sucked into the outer one. And I feel like if you use if you push up or right on the D-pad, it's your tilt function. I think if you use that to your advantage, it really, really aids in keeping him in play. I don't know if... that's something he was aware of, but yeah, it's always worked for me anyway.
Yeah, it'd be nice if you could also remap the buttons. It might want to find it a little awkward to press left on the D-pad and A to use the two flippers. Mm-hmm. I keep wanting to do A and B or so on.
Yeah.
Yeah, or the triggers, heaven forbid, but you know, the game wouldn't have those.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think best you'd be able to hope for in that, I guess, would be A and B, because anything other than that, you'd probably cause the poor thing to explode.
Yeah, unless they make it the 3DS Classic. I mean, all those have fully mappable buttons. I'm trying to think. Yeah, all of them have fully mappable buttons.
Are they done with that now that they got Kid Icarus out?
I believe so, which is sort of a shame, because there was a lot of other games that probably would have been a lot better picks.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, considering, what was it, Iwata was talking to an investor the other day about how 3D seems to have really died off in the whole... thrust of that line is 3D classics. Nintendo may be stepping away from 3D now, so that line may be done.
Yeah, especially with they probably not emphasize the 3D as much in the 3DS successor. So it'll probably still be there, but it's just for hardware backwards compatibility. But it's not going to be the focus. It'll be something else.
I think in that same interview, he's pretty much, well, for one, the 3D was a big hurdle for the 3DS when it first came out, because it was a good machine for many other reasons other than the 3D and everything, even though we could probably all agree that the hardware in of itself build quality doesn't really seem to be there.
Yeah, that's what... Hopefully the XL gets it right, but, you know, hopefully next time around they do a revision because they want to, not because they really have to.
Yeah, hopefully. But the DS was the same way, and the 3DS is that way. Hopefully next time they'll have it really set down like they did with the Game Boy Color and the GBA. I'm one of the few people who really liked the original vision of that.
I could not play the original GBA until I got I had to get the SP, just because the lighting where I was horrible.
Yeah, I prefer the design of the original GBA, but it's really hard to argue about the improvements in the lighting in the later models.
That is true, but they could have just made... Personally, for me, it would have been ideal if they would have just took the GBA and did more like an afterburner, where they added the backlight. And that would have been an ideal console for me, because the DS, the GBSP, the Micro, and all them afterwards, I just don't think hold as well.
We're coming up on 2 hours here, so yeah. I might as well get my stuff cleared away here. As you may have seen on the forums, I'm a fairly recent convert to the 3DS. One of the first things I did when I bought it is that I bought a whole load of DS games to catch up on games I'd missed, because I got rid of my DS Lite many years ago. But, of course, as soon as I got rid of it, some really interesting games went on it. So, you know, coincidentally, the first three games that I got were all visual novels. Ace Attorney Investigations, Miles Edgeworth, Ghost Trick, and 999, which I got on James's suggestion and who I will blame for having played that game. But, you know, Ace Attorney's Miles Edgeworth, you know, spoiler alert, it's an Ace Attorney game. My big problem with it is it's not what Capcom promised. Is you look at the game that came right before it, Apollo Justice, and it was a new character, it was a new era, they introduced some new gameplay concepts, and you dealt with evidence and testimony differently. So you would do things like, find something wrong with this song, fiddle. It was real gimmicky. It was using the DS features, but it was something different from the three games that came before it. Miles Edgeworth feels like a major step back to it's back to the era of the GBA games. And so,
in my mind, that's not a bad thing.
Well, it's you look at it and the game just comes off as really lazy. Because one of the things that they touted right before the game came out is like, finally you're going to be able to walk around crime scenes and investigate things like a classic adventure game. Well, yeah, you do that, but it doesn't really change things too much. And even though there is some new artwork, they're still reusing so many of the old sprites from the Phoenix Wright games. This Miles Edgeworth sprite has to be a decade old at this point. Which for Capcom may be nothing considering what I've heard of their Darkstalkers games, but it's getting pretty sad at this point. And that also extends to the writing. Most of the cast is old characters who return at some point. They have the same jokes they did the last time they were there. There's still a step ladder joke in there. I think they're 5 for 5 on that at this point. I still don't get why that joke is funny.
I'm sure that joke makes sense in Japanese.
I would hope so, because it's in every game. So in every game, you click on a ladder and it says, it's a ladder. No, it's a step ladder. What's the difference? That's the joke. I don't get it. My major problem with the game is that it has the same pacing issues that the Ace Attorney games have had since, I would say, the second game. Where each case is as long as all the cases before it combined. So the second case is longer than the first case, and the third case is longer than the first and second cases. And it snowballs to this last case, which has to be as long as half the game. So you end up with a 30-hour game because this last case just will not end.
Yeah, that's somewhat annoying in an investigation game. I tend to prefer the cases being more set sizes, so the first one can be a little small, but then from there on you're sort of at a rhythm. You're like, okay, I'm about 5 hours into this, so I know cases tend to take this long.
Yeah, so it's the same pattern with every Ace Attorney game. I really like the opening cases, and then I start gradually not liking the cases after it so much, and then by the end of the last case, I'm like, oh, will you just end already? Do I really have to solve every one of your frickin' nitpicks? Yeah, I will at least say this for the game. The fact that they've moved the game outside the courtroom to the actual police investigation does make one of the central conceits of the series make a lot more sense. Where in previous games, it's like if you can prove the flimsiest of evidence against this one person who obviously was not guilty, the game's like, nope, she's guilty. You lose, game over. Whereas in this game, it's like, okay, yeah, if you can't find the evidence against them, obviously you have to find someone who can take their place because you're investigating and trying to find the true perp. So, that makes a bit more sense now. Something I do like, though, about the game is the new logic system, where it solves a problem that the series has had with having you to make leaps of faith for how evidence is supposed to move the plot forward.
Yeah, I hate that. Especially when you had something that proves what you're trying to do, and you're like, but this piece of information proves everything, but you want me to use the red banana? I'm so confused.
Yeah, in this game, a lot of the investigations will have you going around, and you'll find things like, burnt ashes in a fireplace, and he'll add it to his bank of thoughts. Later on, you might hear, for example, there's this piece of contraband that we were looking for. And then you can go into his head and say, I wonder if these two are related. And you'll link the two together, and Miles will come up with the piece of plot that you need. He'll assume that the two are related, and he'll bring it up, and the story moves forward. It feels a lot more natural and, frankly, easier than some previous games. There are still leaps of faith, but not as many as in previous games. The other big problem with this game is that this series has kind of reached the point where it can go no further on the wackiness. And ever since the third game, the series has been trying to one-up the level of absurdity that things go down. You're never going to top the first game where I put a parrot on the stand.
But they are. They have Professor Layton and Phoenix Wright teaming up together. I mean, think about the mind-blowing stuff you can do with that combination.
I really like to play that game, but this game sold really badly, so Capcom won't bring it over.
Well, they won't bring over the sequel, but I think Layton has enough cachet in North America that they might be able to pull something off for getting that localized. My fingers are certainly crossed because, you know, I played all four Laytons. I want to see where they're going with this.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a fun game. It has its funny moments. I really like some of the inside jokes. Like, one of my favorite moments is if you play some of the other Ace Attorney games, is at some point someone goes, "Well, this guy, the only way he could get over here is fly. Well, people can't fly. We know that." And two of your investigators look at each other and go, "You had a case like that too once, didn't you?" He said, "Yep." Because in previous games, both of them had cases where it was proven that someone could fly. It has its funny moments, but it's just too much of the same from previous Ace Attorney games. And I really hope that wherever they go, I'd like to see this Professor Layton game. The trailers looked promising, that they need to move this franchise in a new direction. Yeah, as I was saying about the pacing issues, that's something I really liked in Ghost Trick. That game is awesome, and probably the best thing that it does is that it constantly moves the game forward with these little chapters. These little, like, maybe 5 to 10 minute chapters where you do something, then it ends on a cliffhanger, and then immediately after, it brings you back in with a little recap, and you feel raring to go again. I really wish that the Ace Attorney series would take a page from that book.
Now, if memory serves, Ghost Trick is made by some of the people who did work on the Ace Attorney series.
Yeah, supposedly the creator of Phoenix Wright moved on to that. And playing Ghost Trick, apparently that's where all the creativity went that wasn't in Miles Edgeworth. Because, you know, You have these elaborate animations, you have this awesome music, this really great sense of pacing, and a mystery I was genuinely invested in over the course of the whole game, as opposed to 999. That game, I do not understand how you make a game like that in this day and age. It's basically Myst when you get down to it.
I know some people really, really, really love Myst.
And I really love 999, so...
So Donald might really, really love Myst.
Well, I'm sure I can find it for free somewhere.
You know, it's really weird how the production values in 999 are handled. Is all of the scenes are handled with these still images with sound effects. And for example, if someone opens a door, it simply fades in the door open. But yet they have these elaborate FMVs for doors opening. It's just kind of weird that way. But my main problem with that game is that the plot is really kind of repetitive and the characters aren't terribly believable for most of the game. It's, for example, they love to go on these bizarre tangents. You might find yourself in a freezer at one point. Your characters are slowly dying of hypothermia. One character goes, "Hey, You ever heard of this kind of ice that doesn't melt under this certain temperature? No, tell me more." "Okay." And he spends 15 minutes telling me about that, a mummy that was on the Titanic, telepathy experiments, all this stuff. It's like, we are dying of hypothermia. Priorities, please. And the thing about the plot is, I'm not going to spoil anything, but have you ever heard of something called the idiot plot?
Can't say that I have.
I believe that Roger Ebert coined that term. It's basically a story where the only reason that the plot works is because everyone's an idiot. The way that the characters are in this game, there are characters in this game who know exactly what is going on, and if everyone just sat down and told each other what they actually knew, the game would be over. But, you know, I'll say this. Probably the main reason I'm jaded against this game is that the very first time I played it, I happened to cross into the true ending path. And anyone who's played 999, you know that you cannot go any further on the true ending path until you've done a couple of other endings first.
Yeah.
And so I put in 8 hours into this experience, and then I get to a point where it's reached a crescendo. Something's going to happen, and to be continued. Go get other endings, loser.
That annoys me. Epic Mickey did something like that.
Yeah. Thanks for the wasted 8 hours. The really annoying thing about replaying the game is that although you can skip dialogue, you can't skip puzzles. And if you choose a piece of dialogue that's slightly different than one you've chosen before, even if they have the same information to convey, you can't page through it. You spend most of the game, I think when I did my replay for the real true ending, I spent an hour literally just skipping through text, holding down the skip button and just skipping through text just to get to the point I was at when the game screwed me over the first time. But I was really prepared to hate that game when I got to that point for what at that point was my third playthrough of the game. That ending, that was one hell of a Hail Mary. They throw everything, including the kitchen sink, at the wall to see what will stick. And somehow it works. It doesn't make me think the game is great, but it does make me curious about the sequel. And thinking that maybe, okay, they cut their teeth on the first one. Maybe the next time through, there'll be more stuff you can actually do. Maybe the conversations won't be so stupid. And, you know, I came away a lot more positive about that game than I expected.
So I hear you've been playing some older games in 999 as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Lufia. Curse of the Sinistrals, a game that apparently is so disliked that even the internet doesn't want to review it. Yeah. Funny thing about Lufia, I'm a big fan of Lufia 2 on the SNES. Despite the many problems it has, it's basically Fetch Quest, the game. Lufia 2 is one of my favorite games on the SNES. It did so many things that so many games took after it came out. Now, I believe, was it Steven, you played Lufia 2 as well?
No, Donald played Lufia 1.
Yeah, that, Lufia 2 like was in that summer. I played it in the greatest summer ever, which had like Mario RPG, Chrono Trigger, Earthbound, and Lufia 2. And I sort of, my problem was I stumbled into what turned out to be the 99 floor dungeon from hell.
The ancient cave.
Ancient cave, and could not get out. So I think that's where I pretty much gave up on the game. But I know like they has the system, like there's limit breaks, like it's Final Fantasy VII. They have the monster element. A slight monster element in there. And if I swear, if I saw one more long knife, I was going to break the darn thing's legs.
Did you ever beat the world's most difficult trick?
I never got that far. I've seen the videos of it I've seen the videos of it, because it's basically like the 15 puzzles. You see them actually, I think, is that the one where you have it's like a 15 square puzzle, sort of like what they have?
Yeah, it's like if you know the steps, it's like an 85-step sliding block puzzle.
Yeah, I think there's something like that in every Layton game. So I've probably done it, just not in Lufia 2.
Yeah, I mean, you got some of the best equipment in the game if you could solve it. But I truly believe only one person ever actually solved that puzzle, and then he posted his solution online, and everyone else just used that.
Yeah.
But, Lufia 2 had a lot of great things. You know, it had a limit break system that Final Fantasy VII was happy to steal. Maybe someone at Nintendo or you know, the Pokemon company, I forget the company name at the moment, Game Freak might have thought the whole concept of these capsule monsters that you picked up throughout the game that leveled up and evolved somewhat interesting.
I think Lufia 2, because I know it came out in 96, so I think that was it was contemporary to Pokemon. So I think they may have been thinking along similar lines, but it wasn't like the Game Freak guys just ripped Lufia 2 off. Now, I don't know offhand when it came out in Japan. could probably find out. But
that was probably during the midst of the whole Tamagotchi craze when all of that was starting up. So yeah, it was probably I'm sure it was coincidental, but it's kind of funny in retrospect just how similar the names are in a lot of the concepts. You know, Lufia, it wasn't an incredible game. If you look back on it now, it has a lot of problems. I think just about every town had someone in a cave that you need to go rescue or something you need to go get. It had an incredible ending. It's still one of my favorites in all of gaming. So I'm in GameStop. I'm browsing through. I'm putting down my pre-order on Kingdom Hearts. And I stumble across a copy of this. This, I have no idea who this game is for. It's Lufia Curse of the Sinistrals for the DS. It came out at the end of 2010. It was made by the original team who did Lufia 2, and unfortunately some of the other Lufia games that followed them. I do not talk about Lufia Ruins of Lore on the GBA. Too much pain there. This is a remake of Lufia 2, except it's kind of a reimagining, and it's kind of not. It's, instead of being a turn-based RPG, it's now an action RPG. Now, the best analogy I can make to it is that anyone here played, not the Harvest Moon games, the other ones that went alongside them, the
Rune Factory.
The combat is straight out of Rune Factory, which probably works fine for Rune Factory, since it's not a game really about combat, that's just a feature of it. But for a game where you spend most of the time seeking out and fighting enemies to level up your dudes, it's a really poor combat system. The hit detection's really wonky, the dodge mechanic doesn't work when you want it to, so oftentimes you get hit anyway because your character doesn't respond quickly enough. The plot's kind of funny. Tell me if this plot sounds familiar. Now, the original Lufia 2, the plot had that you had this race of gods called the Sinistrals, or as this game decides to call them, the Sinestrals, for whatever reason.
The Yellow Ring is powerful?
Yeah, the Sinistrals. And so, in the original game, the Sinistrals were afraid of humans wiping them out, if I remember correctly, and so they decided to take preemptive action. In this game, yeah, tell me if this sounds familiar for some reason. The Sinistrals are kind of a mechanism in that world that exists to kick humanity back to the Stone Age whenever they think they're getting too technologically advanced.
Can we say Reapers?
You might say something of that kind. And so, in this game, as opposed to the very quiet opening of the original Lufia 2, in this one, it just starts off with one of the main Sinistrals, Gaddis, just going, screaming to the world, "Hey, we're here to wipe you out. Who wants some?" And your various team members decide, "Yeah, I want a piece of that," and they go off and try and fight him. In the opening cutscene before the title screen, I've played a lot of JRPGs, and I get very used to, if I'm not sure I'm going to like a game, the very first thing I do is I skip the opening cutscene before the title screen, because usually it's some music video, something that's not terribly important. So I start up the game, I see that the guy before me decided to trade the game in when he was level 2.
So he played it for, what, an hour?
He played it for about 2 minutes.
Oh my god.
You can reach level 2 within the first 5 minutes of the game.
Wow.
That wasn't a great sign. So I queue up the game, and suddenly I'm in this dungeon playing as Maxim, the main character from Lufia 2, and he already knows the professor who invents things, the game Sid, and he's already rushing off to meet Gaddis. Like, what? Are you going to introduce anyone? And it turns out all the characters were introduced in that opening cutscene. You have to watch it. But, you know, as much as I complain about the game, I told you that music is something that's very important to me. The soundtrack to this game is ripped right from the original. And I don't mean that, oh, they have, you know, reorchestrated or remixes of the original Lufia 2 soundtrack. I mean, it is the Lufia 2 soundtrack.
Actual 16-bit music in a...
Yes.
Ain't broke, don't fix.
That's true.
And nothing wrong with that. Lufia 2's soundtrack was really good.
And that's the thing, is that Lufia 2's soundtrack was incredible for its time. And so I enter the first dungeon, and it starts immediately playing the final dungeon music from Lufia 2, which is one of my favorite songs. I'm like, oh, damn it. I can't hate this game. It's playing the awesome song from Lufia 2. And I go up and I fight Gaddis, and it's playing the Sinistral theme from Lufia 2, one of the best boss battles of the 16-bit era. And I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to stick with this. And, you know, the game has a lot of problems, but it's gradually growing on me. It's got some interesting ideas. The way that exploration is done now, in the original Lufia 2, you would wander around kind of these grid-like dungeons, and you would fight monsters by running into them. That was another nice thing, no random encounters. The main thing about Lufia 2 is you would solve puzzles in a very Zelda-like fashion, moving blocks, using hookshots, and such things. Well, that's still here, but now instead of a weapon wheel that you pull up to solve the puzzles, each one of your party members has one thing on them. So Maxim has the ability to jump large distances, and Tia, his would-be childhood girlfriend, has the hookshot, which she launches out of a briefcase for some reason.
You don't have one of those?
No, I'm afraid I must have missed one of those. But it lends the game kind of a Wild Arms feel, or maybe a better Nintendo equivalent be maybe Golden Sun. So it's interesting. I really got fed up with the game quite recently because I got up to the point where I had to fight Gaddis again. And that had to be one of the cheapest boss fights I've seen in years. Because Gaddis has the ability to teleport at any time, hit you with kind of an omni-slash kind of attack where he just juggles you in the air with sword swipes. And then he can go up in the air and rain down boulders on you and teleport off to the side and fling energy waves at you. What happens is you're constantly dodging, you hit him for a while, then he basically decides, oh, you know what, this fight's too easy. I'll now activate an invulnerability shield where he only takes like a tenth of the damage when you hit him. And at that point, I'm like, okay, this must be an unwinnable boss fight. He is a god, after all. He wipes the floor with me. I'm like, okay, pop move forward. Nope, game over. You're supposed to beat him. So, and that was 20 minutes later. That's how long that fight was taking. I'm like, okay, I go and I fight him again, and I used up all 9 of my potions. That's the maximum you can hold. And 5 of my revival items, finally killing him. It was nuts, and it does the Final Fantasy VI thing where when a character gets knocked out, the next person in your party takes his place. And so you end up in this sick game of round robin where you've put a guy in for the sheer purpose of being there so you can revive another character, because that guy's going to die in any minute because he's a slow character. So, yeah, that was nuts. But, you know, it's got the Lufia 2 music, and that's pretty awesome. And I only paid $13 for this used. It's hard to say how this game will go because the original Lufia 2 had a good number of interesting plot twists to it, and this game's plot is different, but it's not that different from Lufia 2. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see where this game goes. But I highly suggest when you get tired of the music, to turn the volume off because you do not want to hear this game's voice acting. I joked in the pre-show that there's this part in the game where you're introduced to two bandits.
The sort of quirky mini-boss squad for the game.
Yeah. They look like Team Rocket, and when you run into them, they sound like Team Rocket. They do a whole introduction speech, complete with the whole, you know, we'll spread our wheat to the stars above. And I just start finishing their speech with the Team Rocket speech, and it's amazing how not out of place that sounds. So, yeah, it's a fun game. It's a quirky game. And, you know, for $13, it's kind of hard to say you'd be going wrong with it. I don't know who this game is for. It doesn't have enough new in it to really make it a true reimagining for a new audience. And even though it has the old music, it's too different for the original audience. So who is this game for, and why did Square Enix commission this to be made?
You bought it, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, you. So they didn't get any money out of it. And apparently, yeah, well, apparently Famitsu in Japan, it bombed horribly. So I don't think we'll be seeing anything else anytime.
Yeah. And by the way, this game's failure is probably the reason that Lufia 2 isn't on the virtual console, even though it was rated for the virtual console 2 years ago. So yeah, thanks. Anyway, two other quick games, PS3 games. I played Dyad on the PS3, which is a I hear it referred to a lot in terms of being similar to an old game called Tempest.
Yeah, like Temp.
Yeah.
Like, I'm hearing the name Jeff Minter thrown around quite a bit, which to me only means llamas, but yeah.
Yeah.
Where the Tempest comparison would come from.
Yeah, this is one very weird game. And by the way, if you're a games writer, and the only way you can think of to describe this game is as A, a mind trip, or B, an acid trip, you need to look into getting some creativity. Every single reviewer has called it that. This is an interesting little game. Apparently it was made by an extremely small team of maybe one or two people for a company called Right Square Bracket, Left Square Bracket Games. That's bizarre. But the game has you, basically you are a squid thing that is moving around in this multicolored tube. The whole concept of the game is that you are finding these little glowing nodes that come down the pipe, and you hit them in matching pairs to fling yourself forward. And the game adds more mechanics on top of that, such as if you come close to the center of one of those nodes after you've activated it without touching it, you get a little bit of energy, and that eventually builds up to you being able to do this super speed forward where you can just blast through things. Because otherwise, if you go through the center of something, the game considers that a fail state, and it kicks you back a small distance and slows you down. And a lot of the game is based around racing through checkpoints. The game does a really good job of introducing new concepts, but it has a problem where it's kind of random exactly how, when you have to play the game in a very technical fashion, because a lot of the game, you're supposed to be able to play this as kind of a sit back and just flow with the electronic music, man, sort of things. But in order for you to do well, you have to be constantly matching pairs, and you're moving in 360 directions. And so you're not really moving in time with the music, you're moving faster than it so that you can keep the music moving forward. As you move forward, the visuals become blurred and streaky, so you can't really see clearly what you're doing, and that makes it really hard to do some of the more harder goals in the game. And yet, the interesting thing about this is anyone who knows me on the forums knows I'm a big trophy hunter. The way the trophies are implemented in this game is that there are 26 normal levels that teach you how to play the game, and then each of those levels, if you got the best score on that level, has a trophy version where you complete that level and you get a trophy. Well, some of the trophy levels are supposed to be harder than the last stage of the main store of the main game, and yet I cleared some of them by just spinning around constantly and mashing on the A button. And yet some others require you to be real technical. It's really kind of random how the rules are implemented. But, right now you can buy it for $11.99 if you're a PS Plus user. I don't know if it's worth the $15. It really depends on how much you are into electronic music. Because although this game does a lot of interesting things, it doesn't really do a whole lot of different things, so you could get tired of it real quickly, and the constant visual strain of all the flashing lights. Don't play this if you have epilepsy issues. It might really drain on you. The last game I've been playing, it's been talked about a lot, so I'm just going to cover it briefly, is Quantum Conundrum for the PS3, 360, and so on. It was made by Kim Swift, one of the people who worked on the original Portal, and it feels like a game that desperately wants to be Portal. It tries to differentiate itself by doing things that aren't terribly fun. Because the whole crux of the game is that instead of test chambers, you're in this mad scientist's home. And because science, he decided to fill his home full of death traps and floorless rooms, where you cross things by jumping on flying furniture. What, you didn't do that? instead of having a portal gun, what you have instead is you have a power glove. It's so bad. That can flip between four different dimensions. Where, you know, one of them, it turns everything fluffy and lightweight, so you can pick up heavy objects and throw them around. That's the main, you'll use it to move boxes, and that's pretty much it. Then you have one that makes everything heavy and impenetrable. Another that slows time down to a crawl so that you can do things that you ordinarily wouldn't be able to do, like running across moving platforms or jumping on something you've thrown across a room. And then you have an anti-gravity dimension where everything flips upside down. Eventually, all these things are used in interesting fashions, but the game waits too long to do it. Unlike Portal, where you always have the portal gun after a point, it only gets more powerful. In this game, it takes pleasure in taking powers away from you and making you find little capsules to reactivate them.
So it's Portal with Metroid Other M? With the power ceiling?
Yeah, I could see that. It's like the beginning of every room that you enter is find the capsule so you can get your first power. And then use that power to get a capsule to get your next power. It gets kind of tedious after a while. And it doesn't really make any sense. I don't think even the game explains it very well at one point. Because you have to throw these capsules into these nodules that are built into the room. All the while, almost every room looks near identical. And you've got a running narration during the game. They obviously are trying to mimic GLaDOS. But the thing about GLaDOS is GLaDOS was actually funny. And Hugh, voiced by John DeLancey. Yeah, he has a real name, but come on, you're going to call him Q. It's John DeLancey. He sounds like Q. He's written like Q. It's Q. And he has splits between saying things that are helpful and saying things that are just kind of dumb. So you end up with an experience that it feels pleasant, but it's not especially memorable, and you're not going to be laughing all that often. And he doesn't really say things that are spur-of-the-moment funny. Like, one of my favorite moments in the original Portal, and it's a minor thing. It's the very first time that you use the ability to fling yourself through multiple holes to gain speed, to fling yourself across a room. The very first time you do that, GLaDOS just chimes in, "Wee," and flying across the room. And that I still think that's one of the funniest moments in the original Portal. There's nothing like that in Quantum Conundrum. It is a very clever game. It's got some really interesting puzzles. It keeps feeling like it's building towards something it never gets to. And I'm not sure why this game costs $15. And what, is $13 of that John DeLancey's voice acting fee? Because there's so much reused assets that I will tell you that within the first 10 minutes of playing the game, you will have seen every single new object or texture that the game has to offer.
My Little Pony pays pretty well, apparently, if they got him away, if they managed to get Q away for to do a little $15 indie game, yeah. At least what's supposed to be an indie game. But is there, if it's trying to eat Portal, is it even does it have the song at the end, or have you gotten that far yet?
Well, it has a song at the beginning. I had you play it during the show. When you highlight the game from the XMB, I don't know if they do it for the 360 version, it plays a little song that tells you what all the dimensions do. And, well, let me put you this way. No one's going to be remembering it like Still Alive. But, the best part of all of this? Tell me, what's the one thing you never want to do in a first-person game?
Jump.
What this game does, the thing about the Portal series is that often, once you've figured out a puzzle, the actual execution of it is exceptionally easy because they give you plenty of time for reaction and they give you a lot of room for error. In Quantum Conundrum, they decide instead that everything is going to be skill-based because it is first-person platforming.
Oh, no.
All right, developers, unless your name is Retro Studios, first-person platforming is something you do not do. And the first-person platforming in this game is about on par with Turok Dinosaur Hunter, the original one.
I was just about to say that. I remember that being so difficult the first time I'd played Turok.
Yeah. You eventually learned to counter and correct yourself in the air for jumping. But in the early parts of the game, I died so often jumping over the thing I was supposed to be landing on, because so much of the game is take this object, launch it across the room, get on it, ride it to the end.
You know, I find, and that jumping over thing is not just a hallmark of the just first-person platforming. When the first Switch to 3D, I had a problem with that all the time. That's why I really like Flood and Sunshine.
Yeah. If you ever want a good laugh, watch the Giant Bomb quick look of this game, because they get to the worst part of the game before they decide to quit. There is a part, I told you how what the platforming is like. Now, you can't see where you're landing until you're practically on it. There is a part of this game, a major component of this game is dodging lasers. And there is a part in this game, most of the time you're dodging lasers, you're taking an object, you're throwing it in front of a laser, you make it heavy so it blocks the laser. Only sometimes when you throw the object, it rolls so that it doesn't quite land how it's supposed to be to block the laser, and so the laser hits you anyway. But there's a part of the game that makes it even better, because you're not only doing that, but you're also doing that on moving conveyor belts with moving lasers. And at one point, the conveyor belt actually turns sideways, so you're trying to stay on a conveyor belt that's moving in the opposite direction while dodging lasers. And by the way, there's an achievement in this game for getting through the entire game without dying. Good luck with that.
Of course there is. So with that thought, I think we probably need to wrap up our new business here.
Yeah, finally.
That finishes up new business. After the break, we'll be talking about the games we're looking forward to in the second half of the year. And we'll also be talking about why do people hate accessibility in games now. So we'll see you after the break.
Here's a look at the best original content at our website, now playing in the Nintendo World Report forums.
Alright, grab your Bat Shark Repellent and be ready for a Bat Gangster good time as Bat Kush prepares to Bat Host, the newest forum mafia game. Sign-ups in the Miiverse beta end at the Bat Date, July 28th. Oh god, get me a Bat Pun Repellent.
It's not the mafia we not the mafia we want, it's the mafia we serve.
While we're on that side stuff, for classic topic derailment, brought to you by Nintendo World Report's newest volume poster, Nintendo by 1984. Stop by month-old NWR article, Wii U has 8 GB of internal storage. That's 8 GB of worth this thread.
you know, I also hear that there's a little bit of an NWR gamer gathering this Monday, and what's that, you ask? Why, you'll 15 love this NWR community night serving up Mario Tennis Open. Join fellow forumers and NWR staff on July 23rd, 9 p.m. Eastern, or 10 p.m. Donald Canadian time, as they volley for bragging rights in a game about balls.
Chicks dig it, man.
And the rest of you are on your own. And finally, a feature on the site this week, witness several NWR members and forum posters struggle with the rising tide of Lindemann syndrome in the topic, the pre-Wii U backlog saga. Future follow-up topics may include the formation of a Lindemann Syndrome Anonymous support group. And personally, I've got it terminal.
Hey, I don't have a problem, man. I can quit whenever I want. Oh, look, Amazon just shipped my copy of Radiant Historia.
Yeah, my backlog already says otherwise.
So keep following us on the website and check out the Nintendo World Report forums for some of the best and worst gaming discussion on the net.
Welcome back, everyone. We're going to start this second half off with talking about the games we are looking forward to getting in the second half of the year. And personally, I'm looking forward to getting Skylanders Giants, the 3DS game, because I really enjoyed the 3DS game of the original Skylanders, which was an action platformer, and I'm hoping Giants is more the same. It looks to be confirmed that it's going to be an action platformer and not just a walk-on-the-ground type game, which is what the console wants, so I'm looking forward to that and the new figurines stuff. How about you, Ryan?
Well, you know, I'm looking forward to The Last Story. It's, you know, a game directed by the father of Final Fantasy, Hironobu Sakaguchi, in his Mistwalker studio. I'm a big fan of third-person shooters, and obviously of RPGs. And so when you combine the two, because I know the game has a cover system, and you use a crossbow, I think, among probably other weapons. I haven't looked too much into it, but the simple fact that the game has that built in has me very ecstatic for it. So I'm very, very interested in The Last Story.
That Last Story is one of the Rainfall games. And if memory serves, it's also the one that had the system where the main character sort of can do aggro on everyone else, and you sort of had to manage this, okay, well, aggro everybody, don't aggro everybody mechanic for the rest of your group.
Yeah, he has it's a gathering ability, which draws the attention of all the enemies or mobs, so you can buy time for your party to cast spells.
Yeah, it's kind of weird that the selling point of the game is the fact that you can play as a tank. I'm looking forward to that one, too.
I mean, not very many people experience being a tank, especially in single-player games. It's not a typical role.
Yeah. That game just seems to have a real kind of Mass Effect-y kind of feel to that battle system that looks really interesting to me.
I just want to see if the game gets any sort of online traction at all, because I know that's, you know, it's one of the few, you know, few Wii RPGs that has an online multiplayer component. So I don't know what sort of system it's using. If it's just going to use system friend codes, considering it's a Nintendo game, I would hope it would, or if it's just going to be, it's going to have its own. But you know, I'm going to be picking it up hopefully before the next couple of months, and you know, if possible, that may be something they might do on a game night, a community night in the future.
I'm still holding out for Pandora's Tower.
I don't see that game coming over here. It's too late at this point.
It might be something like a golden classic on the Wii U if it ever gets that far. But yeah, I really doubt it'll ever come stateside either.
Yeah, it's either going to be like a download title on the Wii U if we're lucky, or XSEED might pick it up because they don't mind being the last ones at the door on a system.
Well, they're still supporting PSP, so you know it's possible.
Yeah. And that's even deader than the Wii is right now. So, speaking as someone who knows from experience, but my game that I'm excited for later on the year, I always go with the obscure stuff. Actually, it's the 999 sequel, Virtue's Last Reward, for the it's 3DS and PS Vita. European listeners, just so you know, Vita's region free. You can get it there. 3DS got nothing confirmed as of yet, but I'm hoping Rising Star or Ghostlight will get their, you know, what's in gear with Chunsoft and see what they can do as far as getting you guys a release on the 3DS version, because you never got 999 initially. It's still going to have the visual novel aspect to it, but you do have more of a full range of motion now. It's not Myst anymore. It's more of an adventure game when you actually get to the puzzle scenes. And I took economics courses in university, so I'm kind of familiar with the prisoner's dilemma, and it's going to use that mechanic a lot in this game. So it'll be interesting to see how many times I'm going to get shafted by the storyline. I'm a bit of a masochist like that.
Yeah, I hope so. That was more of what I expected from 999, and the game was a lot more linear than that and dictated a lot more of what I was going to do than I wanted to. But, you know, that sounds interesting. Didn't that game originally have the name Good People Die, if I remember
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was Good People Die initially. I still think of it as that. I don't know if it was just a trademark issue or they just didn't want to have, you know, the die right in the title. Because I know it's the only M-rated DS, 999 was the only M-rated DS game I ever bought, so... So it's going to be rare just for that, like an M-rated game, and it's M because of, like, the violence is all off-screen, but it's there. It certainly was there in 999, and, you know, if they're calling it, like, a Good People Die, it's probably going to be even worse this time around, so...
Yeah, Good People Die would not fly here in the South. Just having that on the shelf would just rile all the religious communities around here.
Yeah.
Well, wow, who'd have thought I'd be the whimsical person of this group? Yeah, the game I'm looking forward to, it's a PS3 game, it comes out in October. If you weren't following the game, you wouldn't know about it because Sony doesn't really seem to want to talk about it, and that's Sly Cooper Thieves in Time, or Sly 4 as it's more commonly known. This game's not being done by Sucker Punch, but it's being done by the people who did the excellent Sly Collection for the PS3 a few years ago. Now you play as an as a cartoon raccoon going around stealing stuff and planning massive heists. At this time, you're traveling through time, meeting up with your ancestors, and getting into all sorts of wacky shenanigans. You know, I was a big fan of the first three Sly games, and you don't really see cartoon mascot platformers anymore, except for the Mario series, so it's a nice change of pace from the stuff that I usually play.
I always say I'm going to get a Sly game, and then I never get around to it. In fact, I said that about the Ratchet & Clank series until the PS3, which I got. At that point, I did finally get one.
Well, funny you should mention that, because are you planning on getting the Ratchet & Clank HD collection that comes out next month?
I'm not sure. I've thought about it. I've eyed it, but I still haven't gotten the second game on the PS3 yet, because it never dropped price, it seemed like. Should finally be lower.
Crack in Time is really good, but the reason I bring that up is, coincidentally, Sony just announced that if you buy the Ratchet & Clank HD collection next month, it comes with a playable demo for Sly 4. So, yeah, I'm definitely going to be picking that up and checking it out.
Yeah, and this one's also, apparently they also announced it's going to be on the Vita as well, you know, for a system that's supposedly dead. We seem to have a lot of Vita left tonight.
Yeah, and that's another reason why it's astonishing that Sony didn't talk about it at all at E3. It's one of the few Vita games that we know of that's releasing this year.
Is Sly 4 going to be one of the games where you buy one version and get the other one? Because they've talked about that before the Vita launched, but I haven't really seen that in action yet.
We've seen that with downloadable titles that are on both platforms for the most part, but the closest analog in the retail games is, I believe it was, what was it, Sony's baseball game.
MLB 12, the show.
Yeah, and apparently if you bought both versions of the game, you got a significant discount on the Vita version. I think it was something like $20 or $30 off.
Yeah,
so,
I think it worked out. You got it was both games. I saw it here for $90, so it's probably $80. For the two of them, so yeah. You basically think of it as $40 each, or you know, $20 for the Vita version.
I mean, I love playing games on my Vita, but I'm not going to get the Vita version unless they flat out give it to me, just because I don't see the point in playing the exact same game on the handheld. I'd rather have an original Sly Cooper game on the Vita. And yeah, you know, considering Sony's trying to make a fighting game of their mascots, and we know they don't really have a mascot, it's kind of bizarre that they chose to not talk about their one mascot, you know, AAA game that comes out in the fall in Sly 4. Especially now that The Last of Us has been pushed back to next year. So now they only have that, their Smash Brothers game, to tie them over in the fall.
Yeah, the All-Star Battles looks actually sort of interesting how they're doing the combat system, because it's been a while since I read about it, but they're doing a system where you have to build up pretty much a power gauge, and then once you hit the power gauge, you can actually knock someone off, but until then, you can't.
I just had to shake my head at the fact that they just hired Seth Killian to do from Capcom to be like a community manager for the game, and first announcement he makes is that the game's going to support fight sticks. I mean, do you really need to play a mascot fighting game with a fight stick? Or is every level going to be Final Destination in this one?
Yeah.
Well, at least it'd be prettier than just Final Destination. I mean, but the PS3's got a pretty large contingency of people with custom fight sticks and just a fighting contingency on them, from what I understand.
Well, it helps that you don't have to pay for online on the PS3.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of what systems Evo's using right now, because I think they've finally standardized to one.
See, isn't the reason, though, for a fight stick to make all the little, like, down-forward motions or whatever, make that easier to do your moves? Because, like, in a Smash Brothers type game, you don't have that.
Well,
it's just a direction in the button.
Yeah.
The fight stick has sort of transcended just that. It's the honor of having your own custom. It's yours. And at different conferences, you can actually win people's. But it's your own custom tool, set up how you want it. It's got as much drag you want it, as much push you want it. You want the button softer, you put in different buttons, you put one of them harder. But you've made this. It looks how you want it. It's yours. It's like customizing a car at that point. So there's sort of a prestige to having the fight stick and using the fight stick.
Yeah, I hope that, you know, they put in code so that if you put in the Smash Brothers game and you pick Kratos and you're using a fight stick, the game just laughs at you. Because, you know, spoiler alert, square square triangle is square square triangle, whether you have a fight stick or not.
So a Fox McCloud fan from Smash Brothers fight stick would have a little button that was just for the Landmaster.
I can't see the competitive crowd getting into this, considering the whole point of the game is to build up a final smash. Don't they even ban those in tournaments?
Yeah, plus the fact that your normal attacks don't really do any damage. It just builds up a meter. So, yeah, what's the point of your technical fighting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be really interesting to see how this game plays out.
Yeah, it's going to be. Well, that's what we're all looking forward to. Feel free to write us in about leaving comments what you guys are hoping to see coming out, what you're really excited for, what you think might be a surprise announcement. Notice none of us said we were going all for the gold.
Yeah, and hopefully your game of choice doesn't get bumped to 2013 like everything else.
Oh, Lord, that's been a big trend this year. Lots of bumping. Everything bumping.
So I guess the sort of last thing we'd look at here, just because I know we're getting pretty heavy on the time here. Something actually that Austin, you mentioned hearing on a different podcast a few weeks back about with game journalists complaining about how games are becoming too accessible. Is that sort of what we're looking at here?
Yeah, I've got the quote right here. This just came to mind. I was playing the Amazing Spider-Man game a few weeks back, and they were talking about it on episode 214 of GameTrailers.com's Invisible Walls, and editor-in-chief Shane Satterfield said the following, you know, paraphrase, Amazing Spider-Man brings to bear a bigger point for me, which is it just seems as games go on, they just take more and more control away. I just feel like the whole industry is not catered to us anymore. The people who want to have control and actually get good at web-slinging. Like, it's all for the people who buy like 10 games a year now to make sure that when they pick it up, they're not going to be frustrated. They're going to be able to like hit the win button to get through the game. It's very frustrating to me to watch the whole industry kind of heading that way. It's like, you know, I don't know what you can do at this point. I'm sure they've done all their studies and they're, oh, a certain percentage of people will only finish our game. And if we do this, then a higher percentage will finish it. I just think it's a little disappointing to see the industry kind of heading in that direction right now, end quote. All right, first off, in what universe is buying 10 games a year considered casual now? I mean, I thought the casuals bought Wii Sports and that was it for the year.
Or they buy Madden, Call of Duty, and, I don't know, NBA.
I'd even throw a Grand Theft Auto in there, too.
Yeah, except they don't come out as often anymore. But yeah, you know who buys 10 games a year? Me.
Yeah, and at least that for me, but yeah.
I mean, I actually, the last few years, I haven't even bought 10 games a year really thinking about it. This year's a big exception with the DS coming out. But yeah, for a couple of years, I've pretty much, WoW was most of my gaming because there wasn't really anything out I wanted to play.
Well, yeah, and, you know, setting aside Spider-Man for a moment, you know, whatever you think of that game, I really don't like this general mood that I'm hearing from various corners of the internet and the, you know, the hardcore people. You know, I consider myself a hardcore player, but this notion that it should be really difficult for someone to finish a game. That, you know, you should have to work for it. It reminds me of when Ninja Gaiden 3 was announced. Now, we know there are a whole lot of problems with that game. The one that always bugged me is that the thing that the fanboys always clung onto was, oh, they've made it easy. You know, anyone can beat Ninja Gaiden now. Really? That's your problem? That someone can actually finish your game? I don't understand that.
There's prestige in hard games and everything, but a lot of games are just hard. I don't like it when a game is hard to be hard. They've talked about it on RFN before. I like it when a game is fair. It can be hard and demand more of you, even to a point where it might be beyond my technical skill level, and that's fine. Fighting games are actually a good example. I'm never going to fight at a competitive level. Never. It's just not something I can do. But it's fair. I know I can't do that because I just don't have the raw skill set for it. But I can get to the point I am, and it's not arbitrarily hard to do that in a good game.
Yeah, for me, As long as I can see all the content in a game, I'm content. Maybe I can't get the best score. Maybe I can't get all the achievements, even as big of a trophy hunter as I am. You know, I'm satisfied so long as I can see all the content.
And I, like, I've mainly been going with RPGs, which I know the games I've been playing lately, they have, you know, you end up with a situation like a Final Fantasy 13 where you have, what, 30 hours of tutorial before they actually let you explore anywhere.
Yeah. Or Skyward Sword, which has like 20 hours of tutorial.
Yeah. And you know what, especially with Skyward Sword, I appreciated that just because, you know, I needed the practice. And I think where they're coming from is they think back to, you know, when they were kids, they see these, you know, they see that, yeah, I was hardcore enough to beat Ninja Gaiden even when I had to go back to 6-1 for the 30,000th time, or I beat lost levels when I was, you know, beat lost levels in one life. And they, I don't know if they're just thinking that if the people that are saying the game, it's a problem, the game's accessible, they think everybody should be able to meet their standards for what a hardcore gamer is.
Well, but there's some problems with that nowadays. I mean, the big problem with back in the NES days, you didn't have that many real, truly real variety of games. The Batman game was actually a lot like the Mario game when you boil it down to the platform, but it happened to have weapons. You had a lot of games that were almost reskinning some of the games because that's what the technology could really handle. They were just different ways of set. So you got really good at them, so they could demand more for you because there was a lot of stuff that was just being assumed. Super NES is probably, things start to break down a little bit more there, but it's still one that considered the golden age of gaming by a lot of people, and it still has a lot of games that are pretty much reskinning of each other because there's just so many different types of mechanics, and you just sort of intrinsically knew them. Then comes the N64 time. We get 3D becomes more persuasive. You get analog, and then things start breaking down at that point. And then we get to today. What games are demanding of people from one system to another, even in the same game, can be vastly different. The Wii version has motion controls. And maybe you have to point and shoot on something with the pointers thing, while the PS3 version is just pure controller sticks, and then the Xbox 360 version is Kinect, where you don't use the controller at all, and you're using your actual body to do things. We don't have these set patterns and archetypes that we used to have as much, and so it becomes the developers' jobs to teach you these whole new systems of play that are more vastly different from one another than they used to be. I think that's part of the reason you see this general, well, I like to have it harder again, but to do that, we would have to have more games to uniform, so you have games to practice on to get to this point, or games that are longer. But then that leads to a lot of inflation. That just doesn't need to be there.
Yeah, plus I think what a lot of people overlook in their nostalgia is that the games on the NES weren't hard because they were hard. They were designed to be hard. They were hard because they were cheap. When in Ninja Gaiden or Mega Man, you jump over a pit, something flying is going to come at your face and knock you back into the pit. Or Castlevania, for that matter.
Yes.
You know, enemies will shoot you from off the screen. You'll kill an enemy because of the hardware limitations. You'll move slightly to the side. The enemy will respawn. Mega Man, you jump into a pit. It scrolls down to the next screen. There's a bed of spikes below that you would only know they were there if you'd memorized it. You know, a lot of the old difficulty was built on cheapness. And so I take a lot of the complaints about, you know, games are too easy, games are, you know, anyone can beat this with a grain of salt. You know, everyone knows I've criticized Nintendo a lot for various things over the years. But the one thing I will give them with the Wii is that they reminded developers that games had become too inclusive. That you go into Splinter Cell, or Metal Gear Solid, and you've got 50 different commands to do an assortment of things that aren't, it isn't immediately clear what they do, and then, you know, in Splinter Cell, you're spotted, and back to the start of the mission for you if it happens three times. And, you know, I think the mistake that Nintendo made with the Wii is that they assumed that the problem with its inclusiveness was that people were intimidated by the controller. I don't think so. I think the problem is that they were intimidated by the mechanics that had sprung up over the years that, you know, games like the ones I named, that games were very complicated. There were too many functions and things that people needed to remember and too many archaic paradigms. And nowadays, you know, we have our stealth games are things like Batman or Splinter Cell Conviction, where, you know, it's not an instant fail if you get spotted. You just go out and you beat them into submission. It's, you keep the game going and you allow people to see the content just because they aren't extremely talented or willing to memorize everything. They can still have fun. And I think that's the important thing is developers were reminded that games need to be fun. They don't need to be punishing. You don't need to prove your manhood or whatnot. And we still get games that do that. We have our Dark Souls, we have our Demon Souls, you know, Super Meat Boy, things like that. But the industry as a whole is reminded that there are people other than us that play games, and they would like to see what's in the games.
Yeah, and I like to take a little bit on that control stuff. I reached, not too long ago, I decided, okay, I'm going to buy some sports game. And so I got Madden, I think it's 2010. It's like a year or two old. It was 99 cents. And one of the baseball games. And so I'm getting in there, and I was like, okay, well, this is a Madden game. I haven't played one in a while, but it's a football game. How hard can it control? Well, pretty darn hard, I found out. It was not intuitive at all for someone just stepping in there. I'm like, this is stuff that they used to do just with two buttons and a directional pad. It was pretty much everything you needed for this particular sport. And the baseball game, don't get me started on that one. I booted up, and I can't swing the stinking bat. It's like, do I use the right analog stick? And I move it around like this, and then I have my tummy and pat my head. It's just that obtuse anymore. This is coming from someone who plays a lot of different games. Not in the sport genre, par you, but I do play a lot of different things.
You know, maybe what they need next for the next generation, because honestly, at this point, new graphics doesn't really mean anything to me. I was perfectly happy with what I had on the GameCube and the PS2 and to a lesser extent the Xbox. Next generation, you know, instead of using the processing power to pump out higher res graphics, maybe they can use the added power that the next systems are going to have, whatever that ends up being, to make it so that a game can sort of adjust itself on the fly so you have a fair experience. If you're someone who can beat Dark Souls with your eyes closed and, you know, one arm tied behind your back, then fine, you get, you know, you want your hard game, you got it. But, you know, if I'm playing a first-person shooter, because I've played 3 first-person shooters in the last 15 years, I'm going to need a lot of help, and I want the system, I want to be able to, for the system to know and adjust appropriately as I get more into practice with first-person shooters if I decide to pick that up.
See, variable doing things is relatively hard programmatically wise. It's sort of one of those cool concepts which goes hand-in-hand, sort of like enemies leveling with you seems like a cool concept on paper, but it's really not in practice. I personally prefer ranks. I think ranks are a good middle ground on that where, okay, well, I go through this, and originally I got a C rank. And so the next time I want to get the S rank. And so then it starts becoming that the more hardcore people try to do things like S everything. And the people who just want to go through is like, well, I really don't care about this flashy number. I just want to see the story. And they'll just sort of move on.
Yeah. I'd also point out that if you really want that challenge, a lot of games have achievements for that very purpose. If you want to prove that you've mastered the mechanics, you know, check out the achievement or trophy list sometime. There might be something in there that will really challenge how you do it. I know I didn't think much of Final Fantasy XIII's mechanics at first until I really started poking into the trophy list. And having that, I thought, oh yeah, I actually have to master this paradigm system. It's not as easy as it looks.
Yeah, achievements are a great way for developers to add in extra challenge to your game, but it's also a very good way for them to talk to you in a game. Well, you know, you can do it like this normally, but you should try like this too. It might be a little bit harder, but you might find it more satisfying. And you can actually do that, and people will know you've done it like this. You've beaten this boss without losing any lives. You've, instead of using the fire talisman, you use the water talisman, which might not be as strong, but opens up a totally different mechanic on how you do this fight. So now it's just totally different than what you did before, because no longer a offensive fight, it's a defensive fight.
Yeah. It's actually something that Kid Icarus is very good about. I mean, not only do you have the achievements, but you also have entire sections of levels that are optional that you can open if you're playing on a high enough difficulty.
Yeah. That is a good way how they do that gating, and it prompts you to turn around and go, well, I did beat this in three hearts in Kid Icarus, but if I do it in rank 5, I can open up, like in the first area, the tank boss, and I can get more loot that way. It's a different challenge. Everything is more challenging. I'm not a big fan of hard modes that are just there to be harder. Personally, I personally feel that a harder mode should open you up to little changes. So, like, the most basic mode will get you the full story, but the harder mode will fill in more information by side quests and stuff that you couldn't do. And that's how they make it more difficult, is they put you into these harder areas that they can do that because they know you're ready for them. I really like when games do that.
I think another example is something like Mega Man 9, which that game was balls hard, but
it had
the achievements. So if you were insane enough to go through that entire game without getting hit, which I'm not even sure if that's even physically possible, but the achievements there for it. So if you want to go for it, then best of luck. As for me, I was perfectly satisfied. You know, I beat that game within a week or so, and gave me, you know, I was able to get, you know, I didn't go out of my way to make it harder for myself than it already was, but I still had a good time with it.
Yeah. Also, another, stats are also a fun way to make a game. But I'm personally a stat junkie, so a game that has a lot of stats in it, and like how many times I punch, how many times I kick, you did this move this many times, this is the percentage of these type of enemies you've taken off. I really do like that type of stuff. And some games, it's sort of fun to see, well, I'm going to redo this level. And the first time I did this, I totally avoided this one type of enemy, but he's there. I'm going to find him now, and I'm going to make sure I get X of them. Stats are sort of an interesting way for personal challenges, too. I like having those.
Yeah. Something, though, that I am really glad that we've dialed back on is stats in RPGs, where it's like, oh, you level up. Would you like to assign 1 to dexterity, charisma, strength, magic, all that stuff? For the vast majority of people, they mean nothing. I mean, I'm an RPG fan, and even I couldn't tell you what dexterity means in a lot of games and what it actually impacts.
That's true. I am glad they have started simplifying stat systems, because you just get to the point where it's like, well, okay, why do I have dexterity when I have agility? Why do I have strength when I have attack power? Why do I have...
Well, you know, the initial version of Final Fantasy XIV did that. It had individual stats for every single characteristic you could think of, and it just got so complicated, and you really had no clue what was affecting what, or if it was even affecting it at all. And they've changed that since then. So,
yeah, well, it's the same way. The few recent expansions and everything, they keep simplifying the stat system. There used to be spell haste. There used to be spell power. It originally started, there was healing spell power and attacking spell power. Then there was just spell power. And then there used to be spell haste and melee haste. And now they're just haste. Simplifications like that make sense in a game. It's like, okay, pace makes you go faster. It doesn't matter. It's a stat. It's not actually something you give to somebody.
Yeah, plus in the vast majority of games, the stats are kind of secondary anyway to pretty much how you use your abilities and whatnot. So, you know, you get an idea of where we've come Anyone here play the original Knights of the Old Republic? You know,
I have.
Yeah. Do you remember how they always used to represent your damage as dice rolls? Dungeons and Dragons dice rolls?
That just sounds like a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you what my damage was in a lot of those games. And I'll bet you the Old Republic displays them as just regular damage numbers like everyone else.
Well, Knights of the Old Republic was actually, honest to God, based off of D&D 3rd Edition. In the background, it was using that rule set to make a decision. So dice rolls made sense because it was actually using dice rolls to do things.
Yeah, but you don't need to tell
now,
me that.
In Old Republic, they're traditional MMO numbers. So you just see the number pop up. So if and you're right. I mean, it's for the geek, it's sort of cool to see the dice. But yeah, to the end user, you really don't need to see that. I'm sure there should be. I do still think there should be a mode where you can get at the numbers. So when it's time to make decisions about weapons, you can decide, well, does this weapon actually do more damage? But there should be a clear way to determine that anyway. I mean, upgrades are one of those barriers entry to having a good system to tell, okay, well, this is actually an upgrade for me in a very quick fashion. If you're going to do a lot of inventory, you have to have that.
Yeah, it's interesting, by the way, that you guys brought up adaptive difficulty earlier. I asked earlier if you guys have played the Sly Cooper games. Well, all the Sly Cooper games use adaptive difficulty. In the first game, your character dies in one hit, unless he has a horseshoe that absorbs a hit. Well, if you keep failing at a checkpoint in that game, they'll start giving you horseshoes so you can get a chance to keep going. And in the later games, when they started using health bars, they started making it so that the more times you failed in a section, the less damage enemies would do to you and the more damage you would do to them until you got past that checkpoint. It was a brilliant system for its time.
Mario's got the Tanuki suit, the white Tanuki suit now, which, take or leave it, it's sort of cheap. Once it's available, you're like, well, should I use it or shouldn't I use it? But it's here.
I got through the whole main campaign without ever seeing that suit.
When I played New Super Mario Wii, I actually lost 100% completion because I triggered Super Guide in one level. And, you know, I could never be bothered to go back and get it. Because, you know what? I managed to beat every level in that game on my own. I was happy with that. World 9, level 7 can still, you know, go jump off a ledge. But that actually wasn't the level that I ended up triggering it in. So, but the game rewarded me. You know, I got the full 5 stars. It didn't sparkle, but that's a minor thing anyway. I didn't really care at that point. I managed to beat everything in the game, so I was satisfied with that.
Well, you know, sounds like you've covered this pretty well. You know, let people enjoy the game the way that they want to enjoy it. There are ways for you to enjoy it harder or more in depth if you want it in most games.
And there's still plenty of hard games.
We just had Spelunky come out a few weeks ago, which is, from what I understand, a freaking roguelike in many ways, where you die, you start all over.
If you want a game that'll tear you in half and stuff you through a mailbox, Dark Souls is $23 on Amazon. Go crazy.
Okay, well, I guess that wraps up that topic. Consensus for pretty much saying that, well, go play games. Don't sit here complaining about how accessible they are now. All right, well, that wraps it up for this Nintendo Free Radio. I hope everyone enjoyed it. I'd like to thank Ryan for editing this podcast.
You poor bastard.
I'm so sorry.
Also like to thank Austin and Daniel.
We Donald.
Actually spent a lot more time than you've heard
yeah.
together. And a special shout out to Lemonade for his help in getting some of this together.
And to Sarah from Iowa City, I'm sorry we couldn't get to you. I don't know how you figured out we were doing the show this week, but thanks for writing in. We'll pass it on, and maybe you'll get that on the show next week.
Assuming our editor doesn't shoot us all in our sleep.
He would have to find us first. We're on Twitter. You're welcome to follow us. I am Sarah Me. That's my Twitter handle, right?
Sarah Kimmy.
And my last tweet was, the route home is pretty backed up. Darn you, Poutine.
I'm at Donald Mick. That's M-I-C-K. My last tweet It's actually spawned from another podcast. The Seinfeld of games is something that was funny in the 1990s, but is incomprehensible now. Would that be the first Lunar?
I am at Ryan Clay. And my last tweet actually wasn't really anything major. It was just a response to a friend. Will do!
Well, I'm BroodWars64 on Twitter, and I'm going to go back a few tweets here because some of these aren't appropriate to talk at this time. At this point, here we go. Maybe now that the Kingdom Hearts team isn't busy working on a game that'll never come out, they can actually work on Kingdom Hearts 3.
Another game that'll never come out.
Never!
I actually got a tweet to that saying just about that from a friend of mine, too.
Just a couple things I suppose we should plug here. By the time you hear this, there's going to be a new episode of Connectivity. I'm hearing rumors of a Jeopardy game, and I tend to get involved in those indirectly. So certainly check that out. That should be on the site by the time, if this happens to go live on Sunday, then it should be up by then. Of course, Radio Trivia, TYP just got married, so there should be a new episode hopefully in the next few days. And to make sure that suck up to Johnny here, he just posted another episode of the Discovery Music Project with his friend Taylor. The topic is Bruce Springsteen. I learned more about Springsteen on that one show than I have in my little exposure to music in the last 27 years. And hopefully we'll have the regular RFN crew will be back next week, and hopefully we may get together again and do this some other time. But till then, thanks for listening, and keep checking back on the forums.
Bye.
So long.
See ya.
Where are we at? 2.5 hours?
2:37, actually.
Yeah,
2:37. We're not even going to be cutting your topic all this yet. Stuff out.
This episode is all new business.
What do you guys think about the new DSi XL? Sorry, not DSi XL. The 3DS XL in extra large, so you can wear it in giant 40 sizes, right? So. After playing a little bit of Majora's Mask, I understand Tingle now.
Really?
Yes, because as soon as I got in there, I was like, okay, it's Tingle. I know Tingle from Wind Waker and everything like that. And then I go out, and they've got these blobs with the goofy grin that looks like Potion. And I'm sitting there looking at that blob, thinking about the normal blob. And I'm going, I understand how Tingle got created now.
Oh. So it wasn't a drug induced. It wasn't a drug trip.
And scene.
I need water. Hi there, folks. This is Austin Bruce Wars Parkin. We just wanted to leave a special message here at the end. As you are well aware by now, there has been a terrible tragedy in Denver, Colorado. Now, we want to assure you that Johnny Metz, Dr. Metz, from the Radio Free Nintendo podcast is fine. He wasn't in the area, and he will be back with you next week. However, we just wanted to leave this message that however the bickering from one side to the next over the minutiae and details of the tragedy over the next few days, our thoughts are with the victims and their families, and we wish them the very best. And we wish all of our listeners, especially you in Colorado, the best over the next few days. Thank you, and we hope to see you again next time. Take care.